Good Wednesday morning. It's John Pop, Cameron Gray, and Jesse Jane Duff filling in for Cam on Cam and Company. Jesse Jane, hoorah!
Hoorah!
We love to have you here. What are you with the London policy research?
Oh, you have no clue what
I
do.
Yeah. I know
just
how.
You're just Cam, glad I'm here.
Cam always screws up your entrance, so I forgot to do it royally.
Actually,
no, he's been good.
He's got it memorized.
I know. God
because
bless
he
him.
Knows the beatings will continue till, until he gets
trouble.
It right. No, I'm with the London Center for Policy Research. I'm
nice.
A 20-year United States Marine retired gunnery sergeant.
Excellent. Welcome to the program. Let's start with the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, especially not at this table with Jesse Jane here.
No.
No way.
No, so, especially if you call her.
Whew. Yeah.
Oh, he's sensitive. When he called me and I was driving, I kind of bit his head off like, I'm on my way. And he hasn't gotten over it yet.
Can we reenact that call? What are you calling me for?
What do you want?
Are you coming to do the show? Why are you calling me?
I'm like, okay. Did I really sound that bad?
No, you sounded like an angry Larry King.
Call her. What do you want? Go.
Well, now you know.
Anyway, Cam is off today. God bless Cam Edwards, because, you know, when he's gone, I love sitting here with you, Cameron and Jesse Jane, but, you know, the fewer days I have to do it, the better. Honestly, I like being behind the mic, but it's okay.
I would be here every day if you let me.
And God bless you. But anyway, so Cam, we had a couple of days off for the Independence Day holiday, and they gave us Monday off, so Cam just took the rest of the week so he could get a week off. So you got us for 3 days this week. And Jesse Jane will be here today and tomorrow.
Yes.
Thank you so much. And, but Cameron, once again, my hats off to you.
Thank you.
Cam's not here, but so what we're going to do, besides having great input from Jesse Jane and other regular guests, we're going to also replay this week some of the highlights, the best interviews from the first part of 2017 as well. Mm-hmm. So what a show. We're going to be in this hour coming up, John Cardillo with John Cardillo's show, Murder of an NYPD Officer. We'll get into that, a tragic thing that happened up there. And he's got John's the guy to go to about this. Sean Maloney with Buckeye Firearms Association, NRA board member, an article in America's First Freedom on Faster Colorado. That's all in hour one. Hour two, we'll play back Cheryl and Cameron heard me screw this up 15 times in the tease for Siri. Atkinson.
John has trouble saying Cheryl Atkinson's last name.
Because he
stops every time and
Atkinson,
thinks about it.
Yes.
he says it's Southern style.
Full measure with
Jesse
Cheryl
Jane.
Atkinson.
Say her name.
Cheryl Atkinson.
Oh, you said it wrong.
There's no N in it.
There's no N in it.
No, you would think that. Yes, you would think. There's no N. It's Atkinson.
I'm hearing an N.
At the end.
Right. That's what I said. Atkinson.
No, not the first time you said it.
Okay. No, Atkinson.
Anyway, we're going to talk about her new book.
There's an N at the end.
Play the tape. The Smear. And about Fast and Furious as well. And then later in hour two, our good friend, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, coming on.
Special request.
For Jesse Jane Duff. Two Marines in the room, by phone here, and we're just going to leave.
We could defeat the enemy.
There you go.
You know? He'll plan it out. I'll take the hill. Make sure I get all the fire support. I mean, between he and I, you know, we can take out a regiment.
That's right. Seton Motley.
I believe it, too.
In hour two.
I laugh out of fear.
That's not humor you're hearing. That's fear.
That's right.
And then hour three, another playback. Glenn Jacobs, known as Kane, WWE superstar.
The Big Red Machine.
Yes. Running for mayor of Knox City. And about a wrestler named the Progressive Liberal. Knox County, Tennessee. And then Miles Hall, our friend from Hall & Hall Consulting. Interesting, in-depth Pew research on gun ownership report that just came out, and we're going to get into that with him. And finally, Stephen Cruiser from IJ Review, talking about all the news and the important issues, and with Stephen, some of the less important issues, but still worth talking about with Stephen Cruiser. Yes. That's your show today, so strap in.
Yeah, good show.
So where should we start, Cam?
I got to talk about something real quick.
Go ahead. Get off your chest.
So happy day after Independence Day to everybody. John, how did you celebrate?
I was home. We had a really good time. My wife's sister and her family came. Her husband, her sister's husband and kid came down, and who was in here earlier playing with the VR machine that we have here. So, and her aunt came in with her husband, and so we had a nice little cookout. And I tried to do something a little different. I can say a little progressive.
He's a Philly guy with a Minnesota wife.
Yeah.
Deep woods, Arkansas.
Yes. Forget about it. So, but I cooked a little salmon on the grill, and we had a great time. Then we did what I love to do, Cameron, to watch fireworks from the comfort of my basement on my big screen TV with my subwoofer. That's the way to watch fireworks.
Jesse Jane, what did you do yesterday?
Okay, I started the morning off beautifully. I did go to Mass, and we got to sing Oh Beautiful. You know, oh beautiful for a spacious sky. So I got really excited about the day, and then I proceeded to go home and do absolutely nothing. And then when it was time for fireworks, I went down to, and I didn't even think about the fireworks. I went down there to get a drink. To get a chicken salad. It happened to have a drink on the side.
Yes.
And I was sitting there realizing the fireworks were playing on TV, and I live not even a half a mile from the mall. I thought that was just, the irony of it was just, I've obviously been here too long, that I'm watching Washington, D.C. fireworks in Washington, D.C. on television.
It's like the people who go to a tailgate at a football game, and they don't go into the game. They just watch
it outside. That was me yesterday. I looked up, you know, as I was sipping on my second Prosecco, and I said, oh, my God, the fireworks are on TV, and I'm a half a mile from them.
Well, I want to talk about Independence Day.
Well, Cameron, what did you do?
Well, I did nothing. My wife and I did.
It was a boring day. So exciting, aren't we?
I know.
Yeah. Seriously.
Setting the world on fire.
So I want to talk about Independence Day by talking about Canada in odd ways.
Go Canada.
So,
Canada.
So I am I'm a junkie for foreign news. I love watching British news. I especially love watching British election news.
Mm-hmm.
And I love watching Canadian news. I think it's interesting to see other points of view. Of course, the CBC and the BBC, as liberal as the day is long, but whatever. It's fine.
Right.
But it's always interesting to me to get the perspective on it. So there's a man named Peter Mansbridge who is the Wolf Blitzer of Canada. There's a show on CBC every night called The National. And he has hosted it since the 80s. You know, one of those like the old days, a Walter Cronkite type, you know.
Right.
And his last hosting of The National was going to be this past Friday. And I thought, that's going to be interesting. And also on Friday, I was watching, we talk about how boring we are. My wife and I just watch Jeopardy every day. And on Jeopardy on Jeopardy last week, Alex Trebek came out with a Canada 150 jersey to remind everybody that Saturday was going to be Canada Day, the 150th anniversary of the founding of Canada. So I thought, okay, cool. So I'm going to watch Peter Mansbridge's last broadcast because I'm such a geek for that stuff.
Right.
And it's Canada Day. So I just thought it'd be interesting to see how everything's being celebrated and prelude to our celebrations down here. So Friday night, I'm watching it, and he's on top of a building in Ottawa because they're getting ready for their – of course, the CBC is huge in doing this thing on Canada Day. So what was going to happen was he was hosting his last version of The National Friday, and then Saturday he was going to anchor their daytime coverage of the Canada 150 celebrations. So I thought, this is cool. I'm going to watch tonight, and then maybe I'll check in on Saturday to see, it's history. The guy signing off for the last time. I'm into that stuff. So I'm watching this coverage, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's Canada 150, 150 years that they've been a country, and there's a I've learned so much about Canada Day and what's going on up there. There's a big, and it has been for a long time, called First Nations, the indigenous people of Canada, who claim that they've been there thousands of years. And, it's the whole thing about settlers and colonization.
Right.
And so about every story that they're talking about this, hey, it's Canada 150. This is a huge, we're having a great party up here. Every other story is, well, the indigenous people and First Nations, they're not too thrilled with us. And every other thing, we all hear how nice Canada is and everything. They're effectively apologizing every few minutes. This all the correspondents on the CBC and Peter Mansbridge himself are like, it's like, we're sorry, and it's like, and I'm watching this, I'm thinking, you live in one of the most free, Canada has its issues, but it's one of the freest, most robust countries in the world, and you're just over and over apologizing for who you are, and you can acknowledge what happened, and you can give credit to people. Mm-hmm. And indigenous people and recognize them, but every turn it was, we're just sorry. And I'm watching this and I'm thinking to myself, this is kind of what's happening in our country, and it really bothered me. So that was the watching The National, and then on Friday was Canada Day itself, and I was watching all the hoopla and everything, And I learned about some videos that through the CBC, and I pulled them, and we're going to play in the back real quick. So the Prime Minister of Canada is Justin Trudeau.
Yes.
Who, the boy wonder. Who,
the boy wonder.
The Liberals love him. He's a good-looking young guy.
Yeah.
They can't get enough of this guy. There was a picture recently of him and Barack Obama in a restaurant in Montreal, and you would have thought it was the greatest picture ever taken.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought this was really interesting. So they had a huge setup. And they, of course, Gordon Lightfoot was performing, and Shania Twain, and all this, you know, as Canada as it gets.
Wow, Gordon Lightfoot.
So at this gigantic Canada 150 celebration, they allowed the First Nations to put up a teepee, like right at the front, as an homage to the First Nations. You know, really just capitulating to them, you know, not happy about the 150th anniversary. So I saw this clip, and I got to play this for you now. This is Justin Trudeau inside the teepee. Go ahead.
There is so much to do.
We want to turn INAC into the Office of Honorable Treaty Relations.
I've said we have to move beyond the Indian Act. We have to end the Indian Act. But we can't do it with a stroke of the pen from Ottawa. We have to do it with your partnership, with your leadership. And there are people at different points along their healing journeys. Friends in Haida Gwaii moved successfully away from the Indigenous Act. There's still challenges, but they're moving forward. There's communities across the country who have. There are communities for whom moving away from the Indian Act is something that's going to take years.
All right, so pause it there. Pause it there and just freeze that shot for a second for everyone, for people listening on Sirius XM right now. Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, is sitting in this teepee. I guess they call it Indian style still.
With his legs all crossed.
With his legs crossed.
Indian style.
Looking very uncomfortable.
Yeah, in jeans and no shoes, holding a feather. I mean, it's really one of the goofiest things I've ever
seen. What's the jacket he's wearing?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But everything is just around this idea that we're so sorry. We're sorry that we're independent. We're sorry that we're 150 years old. And there was just so much this agita and this whole idea of, we're not proud of who we are. We have to keep apologizing for the past. It's really
bothering. They honestly never celebrated being Canadian.
But that's
what you're saying to me.
But they're embarrassed to celebrate it. They say, listen, if we celebrate this too much, we're going to get the Indigenous people.
No, they really said that.
That's the tenor
overtone
of it. It's so much.
Wow.
So here's the next tape we're going to play is an interview that Justin Trudeau did a couple days ago as well. I think this is very interesting. Go ahead, guys.
One of the great reminders to me, as proud as I am of being Canadian, as proud I am of Canada, I didn't get to choose this place. I was born here, and I can almost take it for granted. And anytime I meet people who got to make the deliberate choice, whose parents chose Canada, I'm jealous, because I think being able to choose it rather than being Canadian by default is an amazing statement of attachment to Canada, which is why I always sort of laugh whenever you see people who are, not many of them, but intolerant or think, oh yeah, no, go back to your own country. Well, no, you chose this country. This is your country more than it is for others, because we take it for granted, we default into this place. And I think understanding that power of building a country that is made of people who chose or whose ancestors chose to build a new life here is really, really exciting. One of the great.
So think about what he said there.
That was absurd.
He's saying that people who came here are more Canadian than the people who are already here.
Right, because you just happen to be born
here. Because you're
Canadian
by default.
Yeah, you didn't choose to be Canadian.
Yeah.
If you choose to be Canadian, you're more of a Canadian than a Canadian who was born in Canada. If that makes any sense.
Right. And instead of suggesting that we should be celebrating the fact that we were born here, mm-hmm. there are so few places that I would have rather been born. Mm-hmm. I mean, most people in the rest of the world are dying to have the freedoms that we celebrate.
Dying
to these countries. They're literally trying to struggle and sacrifice everything to come here. He's got it all flipped around like, oh, gee, I can't even be grateful about this because my mom squatted and had a baby here.
Yeah, right. So you have a prime minister of a country that's celebrating their 150th year that is in such internal turmoil because they feel so much angst about the First Nations
that's
and Indigenous people. Yeah, and then you have a
downer.
Guy. Right, exactly.
Gee, it makes my holiday sound pretty fabulous.
Right. And then you have a guy, and then he says, if you've come here, you're more of a Canadian than someone who was born in Manitoba. I mean, so it made me think to myself that is creeping more and more in this country. And that's what I want to circle back to is because, you look at history and you look at what's going on right now. Like even some Cam talked about last week, Colonial Williamsburg is having financial troubles,
right?
Because fewer and fewer people are going there because fewer and fewer people, I think, are teaching the importance of history and American history. And there's so many people in this country who would want us ashamed of our history. You know, we're a racist nation, we're a colonization, we're colonizers.
I didn't hear any of that yesterday. I mean,
I agree.
I really do have to say that I think Donald Trump has invigorated his audience on a level that is we're squashing all that nonsense now. He's empowered people to celebrate, unlike in Europe, where you see Angela Merkel guilt tripping everybody into taking refugees and they're being silenced with the freedom of speech. I mean, President Trump took an initiative that many people were afraid to take. We were going that direction. I agree with you.
Exactly.
But he's 180'd it. And on Twitter yesterday, I cannot tell you, it was nonstop flags and Independence Day, not even 4th of July. I didn't even see the barbecue tweets. I think I got one of them and I told him I was on my way, you know, because, right. You give me food, I show up.
But that's my point. It seems so long. We were in that lane. We're in the lane of we're sorry.
Yeah.
We feel bad for our history and we feel bad for our past.
Gotta apologize.
And you're right. And you're right.
I think 180.
The Trump presidency has definitely helped us with patriotism. And even, you know, at all the anchors and at the end of the Peter Manzarek's last segment, you know, all the anchors are coming back to him and they're saying, yeah, Peter, we're not like our neighbors to the south where we're flag waving and we're chest beating.
Oh.
You're not even happy it's your 150th birthday.
Wow.
You're every other minute is apologizing for you are. And listen, I think, of course, America, you know, we're not a perfect nation, but we're certainly a hell of a lot better than most other countries in this world. And you can't keep apologizing for your past. At some point, you have to move forward and say, listen, this is us now. How much do you have to do atone for your past? No one here had anything to do with that past.
But not only that, I mean, it's not even about apologizing. The reality of life since the beginning of man is that human beings have migrated and moved. Mm-hmm. And now we're at a point now, though, where we have to watch who is migrating because of the threat of our own national security. We understand that. And yes, Native Americans really did go through a lot of nonsense by outsiders. We know that there was a lot of reprehensible things that had happened to them. We understand that. But go through the history of man since day one, migration, conquering, fighting, wars. Mm-hmm. It's always been like that. And to sit back and say, gee, I'm sorry, my great, 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 how many greats? grandfather or grandmother decided to get on that boat to get the heck out of Europe, wherever they were.
Well, we're celebrating our independence from we were colonized. We were a British colony and we gained our independence. You know.
Did you see the tweet by Kamala Harris, the senator?
Kamala, yeah.
Oh my gosh, it was hysterical. She was so ignorant. She said something to the effect of, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it was something like, four of the founding fathers were actually immigrants, and people like she's doing. And it's like, and somebody said back, no, we were all British citizens.
But that all springs a point that
because we fell under Britain.
You know, here we're our studio right now is in Alexandria, Virginia, which has a very rich Civil War history, and there's Confederate statues right down the street from us here, and there have been Confederate statues taken away in lots of parts of the country, most recently in New Orleans. And I'm also, you know, when I hear all this, and Jesse, as you brought that up, I'm thinking to myself, you know, a lot of people, you know, there's one of the highways here is Jefferson Davis Highway. They're trying to change the name of the highway.
Lee Jackson Highway, Jeb Stuart High School.
The name of the high school.
Let's pretend it never happened.
Right. And they're getting a lot of traction. They're getting a lot of changes there. But I'm thinking to myself, at what point are they next? The founding fathers, because they held slaves, because they did this, they did that. I saw a tweet yesterday bashing, I think it was Soledad O'Brien bashing Thomas Jefferson. I forget the topic, but you know, is that next? Is that the next thing that we're all going to have to apologize for?
No, we don't have to apologize.
I'm not saying that we will, but I'm saying a lot of people are.
No, because there's too many Americans that aren't going to stand for it. There's too many Americans that have the fortitude to stand up and say, I'm sorry. Why won't we leave those Confederate statues up so we can see what the Democratic Party pulled on us? I'm sorry, I'm a Republican, and I know that they led that with the Civil War. I know that they held the slaves, and none of the Republicans were slaveholders.
Yeah, but you're saying we're not going to put up with it. These statues are gone.
But I'm not defending this. So my thing is that the Northerners – that support these statues being up is because it's simply a reminder of our history. All of our founding fathers, all of our historians, everybody is a flawed man or woman. Everybody yep. is. And we are not necessarily celebrating that they fought. We're honoring the fact that this nation had a civil war that almost had probably all the way up to recently more casualties than all wars combined that we had ever fought in.
Right.
That is a historical thing that we cannot abolish or whitewash out of there.
Well, and it's funny when you mention the founding fathers, Cameron. First thing I think about is my daughter, and you're talking about we're going to start rewriting. I mean, it's already been happening. My daughter's a huge fan of the show Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that in there has to do with one of the big themes are, and once again, the words that we talk about on Independence Day, you know, all men are created equal. But back then, it wasn't. I mean, the history was that, you know, that African Americans didn't have those, weren't created equal, and women didn't have those rights either. And we get in this conversation all the time. It's not saying it didn't happen, but it's like, do we start then second guessing everything that we've done and everything that we are?
There's a large segment of people that will.
It was a different era. It was a completely different era. I mean, we can't compare today's standard to what was considered acceptable. We have to address that. We've reformed. We've progressed. We've become better people. A lot of people died for the freedom of slaves. A lot of people died to ensure that we overcame that hurdle. And, you know, one of the beautiful things about living in Washington, D.C., when I actually do take advantage of it, is I've walked up to that Lincoln Memorial and I've read that Gettysburg Address. And I remember doing it once at around 9 o'clock at night when it was very quiet and it's lit and it kind of glows into the night. And it's, you suddenly feel moved by it. Like you have to not be there when it's maybe so crowded and people yakking because it echoes under there.
Yep.
And I remember reading it thinking, man, and it says, woes to the man that brought us this slavery. Like, to heck with that guy. Like, to hell with the person who brought this to this country. We read from the same Bible. It says that. We are reading from the same Bible, yet we're on totally different sides on this issue, and woes to that man. Slavery has been around for 10,000 years. People have to recognize that we're not the first ones that had done this. That's the Yazidi. It's around now.
It's still going on. And the
dangerous thing is, I know we have to break here, is when we do this, Cameron, to take down the statues and change the name of highways, you can't erase history because
I feel a lot of people are trying.
Once we erase history and we don't remember it, you know, the famous whatever philosopher said, we're doomed to repeat it again.
Well,
you just can't do that.
Well, I know that SiriusXM, especially that there's a lot of people listening in Canada to the show, and we thank you for that, and apologies for your prime minister, because that was quite an unbelievable show to watch a nation so conflicted about something that it should be so proud of. And I just want to make sure that this country never gets even
and
close
I agree.
To that point.
And I agree. And we need to squash it every time we hear it.
Yep.
All right. We have to stand up against
We'll take
it.
A break. John Pop, Cameron Gray, Justine Duff. Up next, John Cardillo from the John Cardillo Show. We'll talk about that tragic shooting of an NYPD officer. Right back after these words on NRA News, Cam and Company. We'll be right back after this. Speaking with Carrie and Stacy Stoling with Bright Light Ministry, and I'm excited to talk to you guys about Operation Honor Heroes. Why don't you tell our audience what's it all about, ladies?
Well, Operation Honor Heroes is something close to our hearts.
Yes.
It's a way that every American can get involved and thank and honor our veterans.
That's right.
Both past and present.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an easy way for military families and friends to send in a picture of their loved one who served,
mm-hmm.
send in a picture to us, and then we do the rest. We honor them on our website. We post a tribute thanking them.
That's right.
And it's a quick way and a good way to say thank you to our nation's heroes.
Yes. And one thing I like to add is that if you have time to post on Facebook, you have time to send us a picture. It's that simple.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So why did you guys feel it was important to start Operation Honor Heroes?
Oh, wow. Now, that's a big, I could just do a whole program on that. And I guess that's why we do speak and sing and write books and all that, because we have so much on our hearts to share. We want to share God's love with veterans who were willing to do what, you know, the Lord said, greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. And each veteran was willing to do that for us. How could we not set aside a little time when they were willing to set aside their very lives?
That's awesome.
And we've been through some very very intense traumas and things throughout our lives, and it has caused us to appreciate them even more. And if we had more time, I might delve into that. But for now, we just want to share God's love with them and appreciation in action. And this is one way to do it. And millions of people, thank God, have been responsive to the message. And we're just thrilled to be sharing with your wonderful audience members today.
Carrie and Stacy, how do we get more information about Operation Honor Heroes?
Well, if you go to our website, unitetheusa.org, that's where you go, and there's a link right off that says Operation Honor Heroes and goes right there,
that's
and
right.
You can get in touch with us. We would love to hear from you.
Yes.
I'm a mom, a business owner, and a patriot, but I am not a politician. A few years ago, I founded a nonprofit to defend voters' rights and stop election fraud. We exposed corruption, so the corruptors wanted me silenced. The IRS, FBI, ATF, OSHA, and a U.S. congressman turned my life upside down. Their investigations were invasive, abusive, relentless, and political. They demanded every social media message I'd ever posted, the name of every group I'd ever spoken to, and every word I spoke. I was supposed to give up, but I am not a victim. I'm an American, and I will not stand by and watch while our freedoms are picked off. An attack on one right is an attack on every right. So, I fight. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
All America lies at the end of the wilderness road, and our past is not a dead past, but still lives in us. Our forefathers had civilization inside themselves, the wild outside. We live in the civilization they created. But within us, the wilderness still lingers. What they dreamed, we live. And what they lived, we dream.
And we're back here. It's Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. John Pop, Cameron Gray, and Jesse Jane Duff filling in for Cam. He'll be back in a couple of days. And in the meantime, we've got some greatest interviews of the year so far to play back for you later in the show. But now, John Cardillo with the John Cardillo Show joining us. John, welcome to Cam and Company, sir.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing great. So, Cameron, this story, we were talking about this earlier, tragic story.
I got up today, and I got a DM from John over Twitter, who sent me a tweet that he sent about. This is the first I'd heard about the story, so I definitely wanted to talk to John on the show about it today because he's former NYPD. John, were you in that same precinct or the same area of the Bronx?
Oh, that was my command, and where the officer Familia was killed was literally one of the sectors I worked. I mean, I sat on that same corner. I can't even tell you how many nights.
As a retired NYPD cop, it's got to be an unbelievable feeling just to hear about an officer down anyway, but to have one that could have been you back in your day. When you see a story like that, what do you feel?
Well, you know, first it's infuriating, right, Cameron? And then I still have friends in that command. So, you know, to the rest of the world, she's a cop who was killed, but to them, that's one of their good friends, right? It's one of their coworkers, somebody. They know her family. She knows their families. It hits personally as well because people that I have been friends with for 25 years, basically, 24 years, lost a very close friend.
Hi, this is Jesse Jane Duff. I wanted to let the audience know a little background on this story if they hadn't heard about it. The officer was sitting in an NYPD vehicle when a gunman walked up and basically shot her in the face. She's a 12-year NYPD veteran. She's a mother of three children. She was 48 years old. So I put a human touch to it when I tweeted it out today because I want people to understand that this is just not a cop. This is someone who has a family and children. How does this impact the community that you work in? How do these officers – I gathered that all of the officers had gone to the hospital when she had passed away and saw the family. Give me that emotional tie that happens to the entire precinct. What is the result? And in fact, New York City, for that matter.
Well, right, Jesse Jane, and pleasure to finally talk to you. By the way, I know we exchange our tweets on Twitter all the time, but this is you really hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's a tradition not just NYPD but any agency, federal, state, local, where when a police officer is even injured, they break their leg. The hospital's flooded with cops. When a police officer shot, they're shot in the head. And, you know, sadly, the other cops on scene could probably see she was DOA. Meaning she was dead on arrival, but it's pretty evident. Let's call it what it is. They're going to flood the hospital. There's going to be support for the family. The NYPD typically tells the family whatever you need. Literally, they mean that. They'll send a helicopter if the family lives a couple of counties away to get them to the scene quickly. They do all this very quietly. But this one is so strikingly similar to the executions of police officers Lou and Ramos back in December 2014. If you remember why they were executed, they were doing what's called directed patrol. That appears to be what this officer was doing. She was in her RMP, radio motor patrol, is what New York City cops call a patrol car. She was sitting in her vehicle near a mobile command post. Now, that intersection, Creston and 183rd, is really rough. It's been rough since I worked there. It'll always be rough. It's one of the places that I thought one night I was going to get killed. We stopped the carjacking, two armed perps. You know, they were violent. They had shot other people. It was one of the few stops where I said, you know, this one could go sideways. So it was a rough area. But this was a targeted assassination, and very much like Lou and Ramos. Lou and Ramos were doing the same thing. They were on directed patrol in an area that needed saturation. They needed a lot of cops to try to bring the presence of police to lower the street crime in the area. And somebody, one of the bad guys, with a grudge against cops, decided this wasn't going to happen today and walked up to her and shot her. I mean, she didn't have a chance. The other cops on scene exchanged fire with the guy, killed him on the spot. But this is the kind of thing you can't prevent. You know, the police can't be wary in a free society of everybody walking down the street, right? You can't pull your gun on everybody. And this is what's terrifying about a very asymmetrical, one-off, homicidal lunatic. They're probably going to get through the best defenses.
John, I remember a movie in the late 70s, early 80s called Fort Apache, The Bronx, because back then the Bronx was known as Fort Apache. And the movie, from the best of my recollection, starts with two cops sitting in a patrol car in a corner of the Bronx. And I think it was a prostitute or something, comes in, pulls a gun, shoots them both point blank in the head. And I thought about that instantly because I thought, you know, we talk about how crime is down around the country and it's down in parts of New York City. And, you know, we're certainly not the Fort Apache days. And I think to myself, are we in the Fort Apache days? Is this a part of the Bronx that is just it's not fixable? You know, compare the Fort Apache days to the 2017 days of this part of the Bronx. Are we back to that?
Well, here's what's interesting, right? So Fort Apache was actually about a specific command in the Bronx, about the 4-1, the 41st Precinct. That was called Fort Apache, which back in the day, that area, the Hunts Point area of the Bronx, was an absolute war zone. Burnt out buildings, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I don't want to get political when we're talking about a dead cop, but the free market cleaned up that area. The Hunts Point market started to become a hub of commerce, produce sales. Then they moved in the last 20 years, the Fulton Fish Market up there.
Yeah.
And they moved it from downtown up there. And so commerce has essentially cleaned up what used to be known as Fort Apache. There's still crime, but it's a different kind of crime now. There's break-ins, there's prostitution, there's still violent crime, but nothing like it was. Areas like the 4-6, where I work, the 4-4 precinct around Yankee Stadium, with pockets of it, tend to still be very bad despite the overall crime stats coming down because they're very poor areas. There's Fordham Road, which most people know if they're from New York or visited. Fordham University is up close to the border of the 4-6 precinct on the north side. Gets a little bit better. But as you get into these little pockets, these neighborhoods, like where the officer was killed, still incredibly high drug rate and drug dealing, drug usage, a lot of street robberies, a lot of gun crime, illegal guns, 100%. I never once arrested anyone with a legal firearm. Very important to note. And so those areas, for me anyway, seem to be impervious to the better statistics we're seeing where crime is coming down. Those areas still tend to be what they were 20 years ago, 25, 30, 35, 40 years ago.
You know, John, so we talked about, you know, Jesse Jane talked about Officer Miosotis Familia, who was killed today. But we also need to talk about Mr. Bonds, Alexander Bonds, the deceased killer, who had a lengthy rap sheet. He was on parole for robbery up in Syracuse. He had an arrest for an assault with brass knuckles on a police officer. I'm reading from Channel 4 New York's webpage in a video from posted on Facebook in September. Bonds ranted about the treatment of civilians by officers and talked about how hard life was behind bars. The photos of Bonds posted on the page match a police mugshot. He said, "Don't think every brother, cousin, uncle you get killed in jail is because of a Blood or a Crip or Latin King killing them. Nah, the police be killing and slaying that an inmate and saying that an inmate killed them." So this guy, obviously, you know, he was arrested for attacking a cop before. He obviously hates cops. We've gotten hopefully away from the worst of the anti-cop narrative in this country, especially with now that Barack Obama's out of office. Eric Holder's no longer at the DOJ. We have Donald Trump and a very pro-police environment, I would say, in this country. But there's going to be guys like him. And, you know, when you think about it, if this guy had been behind bars where he should have been, she'd be alive today. So, you know, there's so much need to discuss the broken criminal justice system, which is such a farce. And the thing that drives me the most crazy here is that we're also talking about liberals who want to soft on crime, soft on sentences. And I understand, you know, not every sentence, you know, minor drug violation. And I understand that there's some sentencing guideline changes. But we want to, you know, close down the prisons, close down private prisons, you know, shorten sentences. And it leads to stuff like this. And I don't know what it's going to take and how much of this carnage is going to take before people take a real serious note of what's going on in the criminal justice system.
Oh, the judges are absolutely horrible, Cameron. Look, this is a guy who pretty much proved that he could not live in society with the rest of us, right? Well,
right.
Once you hit a cop with brass knuckles and you're arrested for felony robbery, you're pretty much giving away your right to interact with the public like a normal non-savage human being. Because this guy's a savage. And so, look, this always fascinated me. I think I've told you the story. And let's just real quick digression to the pro-police environment. Where were you and I and Michelle Malkin just over a year ago? This month, right?
Yep.
We were at the White House handing out blue glow sticks because Barack Obama wouldn't light the White House blue for police officers. Well, it's one of the first things Trump did.
Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, the message has been sent. It's been a very loud and clear message. So law enforcement around the country love Donald Trump. They love Jeff Sessions. They feel they absolutely adore Vice President Pence.
Mm-hmm.
Cops I know have met with him privately. Said he's as big a supporter of law enforcement as the president. So they feel that at least the federal government has their back now,
right,
and that DOJ won't prosecute them for doing their jobs honestly and fairly, which was happening under Obama. But, you know, that being said, why is this guy on the street? Look, I think I've told you the story privately. I arrested that there were multiple guys that I arrested 8-9 times for felony robbery.
Yeah.
And the things he was caught for, I spoke to cops up there. He was known to them. He was a neighborhood thug and lowlife and real violent guy. And he committed a lot of crimes against other bad guys that wouldn't press charges and people that were too intimidated to testify against him and press charges.
Mm-hmm.
This guy was arrested or convicted 6 times or arrested 6 times. He probably has committed some kind of violent crime every day of his life,
mm-hmm,
if not every other day, or his adult life. So why was this guy walking around is question number one.
Yeah.
But what is it going to take? I have zero faith. I have zero faith in a city like New York, a city like Chicago, a city like Los Angeles, a city like Baltimore, a city like Detroit, that the liberal politicians will ever appoint judges who are tough on crime,
yeah,
and that the liberal residents who elect the Rahm Emanuels and the Bill de Blasios will ever elect judges who are tough on crime.
Yeah.
It's a really sad cycle, because the people who go out and vote are the elitist liberals who tend to be very well off, and they think it's really cute and you know, almost folksy, and they're performing some kind of social justice penance if they stick these liberals in office, when in reality the people who are suffering are the people in the neighborhoods,
right,
who need hard criminal justice to work. Right? But like black neighborhoods, Hispanic neighborhoods, high crime neighborhoods, they're the ones that need tough judges. The working people,
right,
in those neighborhoods, the working poor, need these thugs, these savages off the street. They're getting robbed like anybody else.
Yep.
But the
do-good limousine liberals that live downtown in Tribeca or live on Park Ave or live alongside Central Park West think they're doing something benevolent for these neighborhoods by giving them liberal judges who unleash these animals back into their communities. It's really very, very sad. And blame Hollywood, because Hollywood, they're out there, you know, celebrating these far leftists. They don't ever go into these neighborhoods. And when they do, it's to shoot a movie with 14 cops around
right,
each celebrity.
Security everywhere.
And they think that they've got the real gritty experience.
Well, this criminal was on probation, 6 prior arrests, and he had presented things on social media that demonstrated hostile intentions. He had even been arrested once for hitting a police officer with brass knuckles. So he was I'm curious where his probation officer was watching his social media accounts or whatever he was demonstrating publicly. I would like to bring it back to a human side of this. Do you know anything about the officer's children, how old they are? Do you know anything about the family?
I don't, because as you can imagine,
I mean, she's only 48, so they can't.
She's 48. Yeah. It's worth noting. I mean, she went on to the NYPD pretty late. She went on at 34.
She was a medical. Wasn't she an emergency responder or a medical assistant?
She was probably. I think she was an EMS with the fire department. Yeah. She could have been EMS with the fire department prior, but that's still. I mean, that's still pretty late to go into the NYPD.
Yes.
Most people in the academy are early to mid 20s. You know, which is commendable. My whole point
exactly.
is that's commendable to take that step. But I don't, because the people that I know in the command were all pretty busy, as you can imagine today. So I expect to get some calls tonight. They'll fill me in more on that. Yeah. They didn't talk to the media about it to protect the family's privacy.
All right. John Cardillo Show. Thank you, sir, as usual, being available and being all over this story. We really do appreciate it. And we'll check back with you for updates as we continue the week here.
Thanks guys.
Thank you. All right, we're going to take a break. Then Sean Maloney, Buckeye Firearms Association, NRA board member, will join us, talk about an America's First Freedom article on Faster Colorado. You're watching or listening to Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, John Pop, Cameron Gray, and Jesse Jane Duff here. We'll be right back with more right after this. We've got some of the gun collectors over here for special curators corners. I love it, I love it, I love it. Who's up next, gentlemen?
We've got Martin Ivey with the Dallas Arms Collectors Association, and they brought one of the most popular displays this year.
Wonder why.
Well, this was certainly at the center of it.
Let me tell you, before we came up to record these, Dana Lash was up here doing a show, and the buzz was going around because you were walking around with that here. And it was, what is that guy? Who is that guy and what's he doing? So we know who you are, Martin. What is it?
What we have here is a RPG-7 grenade launcher. It's deactivated, of course, with a deactivated grenade in it. It is from the mid-80s era. This one actually came to us via the Israelis, as did many of the weapons that were used in Afghanistan. It was a strange, strange bedfellow situation. The Israelis, the CIA, supplied a lot of weapons, Comblock weapons that were captured in the 67 and 73 Arab-Israeli wars. The CIA bought them from the Israelis and provided them to their enemies, basically, fundamentalist Islamic Mujahideen in Afghanistan to fight the Russians.
Wow. Well, this thing's been around. So how did it find its way from there quickly to you?
I've been in collecting Soviet military for 35 years.
You have any tanks?
No.
That's next, right? Yeah.
Martin's published a book on AK-47 bayonets. It's considered the reference work on the subject.
All right. So who wants to handle telling us a little bit about this thing technically? What does it do? How does it work?
It's basically a rocket assisted shaped charge grenade. It's an anti tank weapon. The Mujahideen actually also used them to shoot down helicopters, which is a neat trick.
Well, that's got to be a good shot to do that.
Yeah, it has an expulsion charge it fires very similar to a regular firearm. It has a hammer trigger, strikes a firing pin, explodes a primer, sets off a charge that is wrapped around a Telfin assembly, bolts the grenade from the launcher tube. Look, the grenade goes down 15 to 25 meters, and the rocket booster kicks in. Mm-hmm. And then as it hits, it's a standard-shaped charge, explodes. And it has about a kilo, 2.2 pounds of Semtex or some similar plastic explosive with a metal cone. And we'll take out most light armor. And
it's party time.
Yeah.
Get that thing downrange.
I have a little bit of personal experience with one of these.
Uh-oh. Do we want to hear the story? Should we screen it for... No, go ahead.
No. Well, there was language that's inappropriate for television, which is not uncommon when one whistles across the front end of your Humvee when you're driving down towards Baghdad.
Yeah.
They evidently, some Iraqis were upset with their marksmanship skills, because they were shooting these all over the place and they weren't hitting what they were aiming at. So taking a tip from Ben Franklin, they started tying cloth tails to them, thinking a kite works on a kite. Why not an RPG? And so the vocabulary there followed, what was that, as it went across the front end of the Humvee. We realized they weren't actually targeting us. They aimed for the oil pipeline that was about 100 yards past us. We just happened to be in the way when they fired it off. They actually hit the oil pipeline. But the ones we saw in Iraq, actually right here, Martin, these numbers, this says 1978, does it? Where was this one made, do you know?
This it has a double circle 10 stamp on it, which means it's Bulgarian.
The ones in Iraq actually say "Made in Baghdad," written in English.
Wow!
Right at this point on the trigger guard.
That's beautiful. So
cool. I think every country in the world has made an RPG at one point. The U.S. makes an RPG. I don't know if you guys know that.
Did not know that.
Well, we're almost out of time here, so thank you so much, Martin, for sharing. And wow, that's some impressive
thanks
thing.
Thanks for having
here.
Me.
I think it's the first time on Curator's Corner we've actually had an RPG on. So, guys, thank you so much for being on Curator's Corner on NRE-TV.
Welcome.
And we're back here, Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, John Pop, Cameron Gray, and Jesse Jane Duff. Okay, did I get it right? 20-year retired Marine Gunnery Sergeant and with the Lunder Center for Policy Research.
Oh, my gosh, you're an expert now.
I wrote it down.
You have notes. That's okay. Some people need help. It's
John
all
Pop's
right.
A Jesse Jane Duff fanboy.
Woo.
Big time.
One of many.
Yes. So Jesse's here with us today and tomorrow, and Cameron and I here through Friday, and Cam will be back after that. Joining us now, Sean Maloney with the Buckeye Firearms Association, also NRA board member. Sean, welcome back to Cam and Company. How are you, sir?
Hey, I appreciate the chance to be on.
Love having you, sir.
We love having you on, Sean. And so let's talk about this for a second, because we've talked about what you've done with the FASTER program in Ohio for a long time now. We followed up with what Laura Carno did with the FASTER program out in Colorado. You were part of it. There's a great article in America's First Freedom about what happened in Colorado. We've talked about it from Laura's point of view. Talk about the program and talk about what it was like for you to be there after seeing – you've been there, you know, you've watched this baby grow. Talk about what it was like there in Colorado and what your experience was.
You know, it was an outstanding experience. We've been teaching the FASTER program for over 5 years now in the state of Ohio, and this was the first time that it really spread officially across the borders with Colorado, and Laura Carno, I got to say, did a tremendous job. She by herself did what it probably took a dozen of us longer to do.
Wow.
Less than a year, she got this program put together, and it was perfect. You know, after I've been to so many time after time again, it was nice to be there from the beginning and see the look on everybody's faces, including the trainers. We had the Buckeye Firearms TDI trainers. They came out with the trainers that Laura had chosen. What a bunch of outstanding guys. And it just couldn't have went smoother, and it couldn't have went better. And I think that now that we've expanded to Colorado, I know in the state of Pennsylvania, my home state, FASTER legislation has passed their state senate, and it's waiting action by the House. And we've already had several people from Pennsylvania train at TDI in Ohio. So if they get that legislation, no doubt in my mind, it'll be in Pennsylvania also. But what a proving ground Colorado ended up being. I was never prouder.
Go ahead, John. Before, if you had to put a Vegas odds on it, what do you think happens in Pennsylvania with FASTER?
You know what? I would bet heavy on it. I'm not sure if the votes are there yet in the House, but I can't imagine in today's broken world with terrorism, with the fact that we know that a school shooting is going to happen again, with everything that's going on in this world in America, I think it's going to get through. It had a lot of support in the Senate. And Jim Irvine and myself, we spoke to the Senate leadership probably 2 years ago in the state of Pennsylvania, and we waited and waited. And Mark Zielinski, who trained at TDI, who was a superintendent for the Indiana PA schools, he never gave up. And so it's still going, And I'm hopeful that it's going to pass.
Speaking with Sean Maloney with Buckeye Farms in Ohio. Sean, I didn't know you're from Pennsylvania. I like you even more now.
Yeah, it's, you know what? Home is always Corey, Pennsylvania, and people make fun of me because I never don't bring that up. I'm so proud to be from Pennsylvania originally.
There you go.
And those roots are always going to be there.
So, Sean, tell us, for people who don't know, what is the FASTER program? What's it all about?
Well, you know, FASTER essentially is tactical first aid, combat casualty care, stop the bleed. In fact, in Colorado for the first time, we had a trauma surgeon there that was teaching our students Stop the Bleed program. Then it's mindset, it's firearms training, firearm skills and safety training, and then force-on-force training to make sure that they're prepared to act on their own. Essentially what it does is it prepares an armed faculty member or administrator or just anybody in the school to be prepared to respond immediately if something happens. You know what, Sandy Hook, it was probably 5 or 6 minutes before anybody even had the chance to dial 911. In mass shootings and shootings like this, every 17 seconds a life is lost. Even if they're 2 minutes away, you know, that's too many kids. And the only way to truly take care of this and stop a bad person with a gun is that good guy or good gal with a gun. And it's proven true. The program has been in place, like I said, for over 5 years in Ohio, about to be in Pennsylvania, I'm hoping. Now it's live and well in Colorado. And they were carrying in Colorado before the FASTER program got there. It's just that after Laura Carno visited TDI last summer, she tells us that it changed her, and she was bound to bring it to Colorado. And I think anybody who knows her understands that. She's not going to be beaten.
No way. No.
Well, this is Jessie Jane Duff, and I just want to say congratulations on this success. I had read about it a few days ago on Twitter when actually Sheriff Clark had tweeted it out. And what I think people want to understand, too, is FASTER stands for Faculty, Administrator, Safety Training, and Emergency Response. And your organization gives 26 hours of hands-on training for 3 days. And one of the things that I found fascinating was that it's a practice. Now, I'm a retired United States Marine, so I'm all about understanding how to clear buildings, how to ensure that the lowest casualty rate as possible. And that's essentially what you are training them in. It entails practice scenarios in which the armed protector must find and subdue the threat as students flee the classroom. So you're now putting the teacher in the position of being the first line of defense of those children. How many of these teachers that you have taught have never held a weapon before, and how many of them feel confident when they leave? What is their, have you ever had somebody who was a little squirrely about guns, and did you convert them to understand you can save lives this way? Give me a few scenarios if you've had any.
Yeah, you know, that's a very good question. As a requirement in both Colorado and in Ohio, you have to be a concealed carry permit holder to be able to carry a gun within your school safety zone, but that doesn't mean someone who has a concealed carry permit has any idea or any amount of training. The trainings involved, I've seen people from the beginning that lacked a great amount of skills, and I've watched them grow over this 1 and 2 and 3 day period of time. I've had several teachers on a Tuesday evening or on Monday night when they first started break down crying and saying, you know what, I can't do this. I can't shoot potentially who was my best student the day before. And we ask them just to give us another day, give us a break and stay with us. And I'm proud to say that every one of those teachers that had those emotional questions understand that, you know what, they're not my student anymore. They're killing my other children, and they have to be stopped.
Good.
So we've had situations like that. And then we've had people just with poor shooting ability. Some people, it takes a while until they actually learn what the front sight does, what the rear sight does, and how to hit the target. And all of a sudden, it's like teaching your kid to ride a bicycle. All of a sudden, they get it.
Mm-hmm.
And you watch them get it, and you're so proud. And then when you watch them go through the force-on-force scenarios, where you know they vary from everything to somebody holding a school administrator hostage, to somebody with killing their children, and then with airsoft, to actively go find that person based on common principles and then stop that threat. It is an amazing experience to watch, and I invite all you guys to come down. I guess now you can go to Colorado, and we'll be happy to have you at TDI in Ohio.
That's awesome. Sean, you know, talk about a minute left here. This isn't free, obviously. This costs money, and you obviously could use some funds. You know, how can people help? Where do people learn more? And really, the most important thing is, you know, where do people send the check?
You can get on to FasterColorado.com, FasterSavesLives.org in Ohio. And, you know, that's a very good question because, you know, it's a natural progression that for all these OEMs, all the Glocks, you know, Cabela's, and everybody that's out there to get involved in this and to really do the best they can to save our children. I mean, as concealed carry holders, you know, we've had the ability and we, you know, we can make the decision to protect our lives because we know we're responsible for our own self-protection. And all we ask is that the teacher and those kids have the same thing that we do. So certainly get on Colorado Faster or FasterColorado.com and then FasterSavesLives.org. And you can take it through Donate Now buttons. You can fill out for newsletters. And certainly you can get a hold of Laura Carno at lauracarno.com and Faster Saves Lives in Ohio. And there's plenty of opportunities to do that. And as always, email me or give me a call.
Yep. Sean Maloney, thank you, sir. Appreciate you being on and what you do every day, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You got it. All right, that's about it for hour one of Cam and Company. Coming up, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, Seton Motley, Less Government, and our playback of Cam and Cheryl Atkinson on her book, The Smear.
You did it.
Yeah. Say it all together real fast. Cheryl Atkinson.
Cheryl Atkinson. Yeah, we'll be right back with more of Cam and Company. Go ahead, do it. Come on, you got 30
Cheryl
seconds.
Cheryl Atkinson.
You did it right.
Yeah. I just do like Elvis. Atkinson. Yeah, thank you very much. Hour one's in the books. It's Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. We'll be back with more. Stay right there.
This is a very unique race here, the Bass Pro NRA 500 here in Bristol. Give you a little feel for Bristol. You go around it in about 15 and a half seconds. And you got 40 cars on a half-mile racetrack. It's really, really tight.
Even though it's a tight racing and rough racing, you got to be patient. You can't tear your car up too early. You got to be able to be around at the end.
Things happen so fast, and that's what makes it just an awesome place to be because there's action all over the track for the fans to watch and see.
Our fans, you will not find a more patriotic sport than NASCAR. These fans love our freedom, our Second Amendment, our Constitution, our liberty. That's what this country was built on. That's the kind of people that our fans are, our drivers. And it just gives me great honor to be here.
What makes Bristol so special is this is the last great Coliseum, and you can tell by when you first walk in this place, if you look up and you're surrounded by fans, the track is so banked and you're right on top of the action.
I came to Bristol probably in 1969 for the first race. Probably had 10 to 15,000 seats in the grandstand. There's an old guardrail around it. People sat on the grass banks in the back of it. And it was asphalt. And today, the track holds 160,000 people. It's the last great Coliseum, I guess you would want to call it. It builds so much energy for the fans. It builds so much energy for the drivers and pit crews. So it has something very special about it. That's why they say it's Bristol, baby.
Things just happen quicker here. You know you got to stay in the race to win the race.
It's real tight racing. It's bumper to bumper, and you got to move people and make things happen.
As a driver, I had a lot of fun. Some of my best finishes were here. You know, Austin Dillon and Ty Dillon are my grandsons, and they both race in NASCAR. As a car owner, I've had cars to finish 1, 2, 3, won the race, finish second, third. And we've also, as a car owner, loaded 3 of them on the rollback and took them home. So it can go either way. It's feast or famine.
at Bristol. Now I look back and think how it was on my daughter and my wife when I was driving. So I guess I'm getting payback, whatever you say.
You know, I had put myself in a good position, and it sucks for Ty. He had such a good run going, and the moves he was making were really impressive. And we just kind of let the race come to us. We had a good car all night, a third and fourth place car. And when it all said and done and everything played out, we were the car to win. So it was a bummer for him, but I'm glad we're in victory lane. Go up that hill, I get to do a burnout on the way up. You know, all the history that's taking place here and to be a part of it is special.
We'll take it any way we can get it. We love these fans here at Bristol. They were cheering loud over there in the front stretch and burning it down. And hopefully we can do something like this come tomorrow night. Love this place, and I want to get as many fans as we can in here every week.
Watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
And we are back with hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, John Pop, Cameron Gray, and Jesse Jane Duff here sitting in for Cam. Got a big hour coming up for you. A playback of a great interview with a person, I'm not going to say her name again. Cher Atkinson. Close enough?
You did good.
You did good.
You're all right.
Okay. No, we're going to, now that Cam's gone, Cameron Gray. Oh, by the way, before I get to this, Cameron, yes. I just have to call you out on one thing, okay?
Go, please.
You're always trying to one-up me, okay?
I am?
Yeah, because this really got me upset. Just, you know, I'm drinking a Diet Mountain Dew during the show.
Right.
But look at, show off your Diet Mountain Dew. Oh, yeah. Okay, look, really? Come on, pal.
I know. I have a problem.
No, I'm just kidding. Anyway. We're here for Cam this week, and Cameron was talking in pre-show talk we have. Why don't we take this opportunity, Cam being out, to replay some of the best interviews of the first half of the year, and that's what we're going to do. We got Cheryl
Cam
Atkinson.
Cam only takes two vacations a year.
I know, dude, the guy never.
So in December, we'll do for the second half
right.
of the year.
And the poor guy, like, even saying, if you need me this week, I'll be around. It's like, go, have a vacation.
But it takes three of us to replace him.
Oh,
I know. It does.
And God bless him, because he took the days where we got Independence Day, July 4th, and the third off, he took this week, so he only missed 3 days. So we got to love that. And in, later in the show, in hour three, we'll replay his interview with Glenn Jacobs, a.k.a. Kane, WWE superstar. So that's all coming up later this hour. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North and Seton Motley from Less Government. So do we want to...
And one of the things I want to just talk real quick before we play Cheryl Atkinson's interview. One of the things we're going to talk to Seton about, and well, actually, let's talk about this for a couple minutes after we play back this interview. This Omar Khadr in Canada, as we were talking about Canada in the last hour, this story is really, it's one of the most unbelievable stories, and it just goes more to the utter fecklessness and horrible running of the country by Justin Trudeau. Listen, I understand the Canadian Supreme Court was mostly at fault here, but you know, Jesse Jane, you tweeted about it. Just give us a quick synopsis.
This is really upsetting. People have to let me give you a background. Omar Khadr was a Guantanamo Bay prisoner and who had been released. And he, after several years.
But why was he there?
Now, he had murdered a U.S. Army Sergeant First Class, Christopher Spear. He was a medic. Yep. And he also, the grenade that had killed Spear had ultimately blinded also another U.S. service member.
Right.
So he gets up to Canada and sues them because they had allowed him to stay in Gitmo as a Canadian citizen, did not come to his defense. In fact, had allowed the U.S. to interrogate him extensively. He claims that he was under duress when he made that confession.
And the Canadian Supreme Court agreed with that, amazingly.
And he won a $8 million lawsuit. Now, mind you, this man, his father, he plays the sympathy role. That is, he was 15 years old when this happened. Now, all of us, when we were 15, we knew better than to throw grenades or kill people.
Right.
So he was, you know, I don't want to hear he was just a child. Yes, he was under influence of his father, but to be awarded $8 million, he turned around and he says he's so sorry for it. So my question would be, if you're that apologetic, then all that money should go back to the families.
Sure.
The families actually tried to sue him for $20 million because they were afraid that he was going to get awarded that. That's what his original he's in Canada, they have no grounds.
Wasn't it amazing that they sued him because they thought that he'd make the money, which is you can't believe he'd actually get the money, and they were right.
He
got the money, and you're right. They're not going to get a dime out of Canada, and it's this whole story. We'll talk about it more with Seton because it talks. He's talking about this article about terrorists, and this story is just Canada is very disappointing.
Yeah, they're getting it. They're getting. They felt bad because they called it wrongful imprisonment. You murdered a U.S. service member along with blinding another when you threw this grenade at them.
Right. I don't care how old you are.
Yeah.
Right, neither do I.
Murder is murder.
Murder is murder. All right, let's get to the interview. Set this up for us, Cam.
Well, Cheryl Atkinson, obviously, one of the original people talking about Fast and Furious. And, of course, here at NRA News, NRA TV, we've been talking about it since day one as well, along with the Katie Pavliches of the world. And Cheryl, she has her show Full Measure with Cheryl Atkinson on Sinclair stations across the country on Sunday mornings. And she had a piece on Fast and Furious. And the day we had her on, Cam talked to her originally, it was the release date of her new book called The Smear. So it was a good day to have her on. It was a really good interview. One of the best of the first half of 2017, as we say.
Take a look and a listen.
Right now, I want to welcome to the program host of Full Measure with Cheryl Atkinson. Brand new book out today called The Smear. We're going to talk about that, how shady political operatives and fake news control what you see, what you think, and how you vote. Cheryl Atkinson is with us. Cheryl, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And congratulations on the new book, The Smear, How Shady Political Operatives and Fake News Control What You See, What You Think, and How You Vote. And I want to ask you, because you and I have talked about Operation Fast and Furious on several occasions before, and I think that you were kind of the subject of a smear campaign when you started reporting on Operation Fast and Furious.
Well, yes, pretty much the last couple of years, as these groups that manipulate news and narratives became more sophisticated and organized and influential, pretty much any story I did that stepped on the toes of the powerful, whether it was corporate interests or political interests, generated this sort of organized smear effort. And I think a lot of reporters have met with the same thing. And it's been somewhat successful in squelching stories and, serving certain narratives.
You talk about the ubiquitousness of the smear, right? I mean, is it your opinion that almost every story that that we're paying attention to has its smear artists and its spin doctors?
Yes, I mean, in many respects, if you listen to the people who operate in this universe, who I interviewed in the book, that's what they say. Their own words are. One of them said, nothing happens by accident, that virtually every image you cross on social media, in the news, the other images you see in daily life are the result of carefully chosen narratives and imagery that well-organized forces are putting before you. One of them said something like, everything happens for a reason. Nothing is by accident. And once you start to look at the common narratives you see across many news organizations and social media, with a common language being used, it starts to make sense. We're actually a very diverse nation. The news shouldn't look exactly, as much alike as it does, with the same terms, the same lead stories, the same main stories making the headlines every night when there's so much to report on, except that I think a lot of strings are being pulled.
And getting back to Fast and Furious, we sort of saw that. You were the one who broke this story in the broadcast media. You're doing interviews with whistleblowers like John Dodson, and you're actually advancing the storyline about what the hell happened here, what's going on, where the rest of the media, I think, was very much, particularly the Washington Post, getting their comments from sources at the Department of Justice and the Justice Department telling them under no circumstances were these guns allowed to go across the border unsupervised. They're getting a story. They're getting a spin. The media is picking up on the Washington Post article and the tone there. And so this all of a sudden became, oh, it's a Republican witch hunt. They're just going after the Obama administration. And if you dare to report anything different, well, that puts you outside of the tribe of journalists, right? And all of a sudden, you're sort of out there isolated and alone.
Agreed, and that was the point. That was an organized process. There are emails that show this. Some of them are in the book. Government emails that show how they were trying to turn the press attention away, and they were largely successful. And I'll tell you something that I haven't reported because it's just sort of behind-the-scenes stuff. This was a story that initially Democrats were interested in backing. I received calls from Democrat staffers and committee staffers and members of Congress after I reported the first stories. And they were, instead of just both sides, Democrats and Republicans, going after an interesting story. We didn't know where it would lead. We didn't know at the time this was something that people in the White House knew about, certainly. Mm-hmm. Instead of following it, they were literally trying to calculate how it would play with their gun rights constituents. And even the Democrats were confused as to whether taking on this story would be good for them or bad for them. They were like, oh, I just don't know if this is a gun control issue, a non-gun control issue, how my people will feel. And I remember saying to one Senate, very prominent Senate staffer who had discussed this with me, I said, isn't it just sometimes the right thing to do regardless of these things you're considering?
Yeah.
And he said, you'd like to think so. And that was the last I ever heard from it, from a Democrat. And Republicans ended up picking it up. And so, therefore, Democrats who were interested in the story had to make it a Republican narrative because the order of the day came down that this had to be controversialized and marginalized because the longer it went on, the more we saw it did go to high levels at the Justice Department and even some people at the White House.
You know, and since the inauguration of Donald Trump, the media has sort of decided that investigative journalism is important again after 8 years where it was just sort of a side project. At fullmeasure.news, you had a piece on Operation Fast and Furious. You went back and talked with John Dodson recently, and there was a quote in your piece by Trey Gowdy. You say that members of both parties say that they still don't think they have all the answers as to what was really behind Fast and Furious. Representative Gowdy said, I'm struggling to understand how this ever could have turned out any other way. As soon as the gun leaves the parking lot, unless you're maintaining constant surveillance and you've lost the gun. And then if it crosses the border, God knows what you're going to do with it. And then when you learn that they didn't even let our Mexican counterparts in law enforcement know what was going on, this is the most imminently predictable tragedy that I've been connected with since I've been in Congress. It could not have turned out any other way. We still don't understand, Cheryl, how this was supposed to work, given the parameters that they laid out. I mean, how is this supposed to ever be successful? And if it could not have been successful, what was really going on here? If this had happened under a Bush administration, this has happened under a Trump administration, you know this would be front page stories. But I think, sadly, the media just really, as you say, they were not going to cover this story. They had to turn it into a Republican witch hunt if the Democrats weren't going to do their due diligence on this.
And we never did get to the bottom of it. I mean, there was a lot of focus on Fast and Furious, but I uncovered about a dozen other cases that I ran across in my research in which ATF officials or related Department of Justice agents were doing the same thing, letting guns walk. So it begins to look like a broad-based strategy coming from somewhere rather than, you know, just one kind of mistake being done out of Phoenix. And because the president withheld documents under executive privilege, some of which are continue to be withheld today, we don't really know the whole story. You know, there are a lot of connections and potential connections with alleged CIA operations, cross-border things. You know that we have armed enemies in the past when we've picked sides among distasteful characters. We've tried to pick the least distasteful among the fighting factions, and we've armed them in the past. Is that what we were doing here? Were we helping arm the Sinaloa cartel against the Zetas, who we figured were more involved with terrorists and were more dangerous? I don't know, but I do think that there were components of this operation that were never revealed and may never be.
Speaking again with Cheryl Atkinson, maybe one day, Cheryl, the documents, maybe if they're in the Obama library, you know, 25, 30 years from now, they'll be opened up to the public.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is once so much time goes by, in all seriousness, I feel like the chance of getting documents, whether it's for this or unmasking documents about alleged political use of intelligence or whether it's my FBI file, these things, when they're withheld for so long, if they're that potentially damaging, mm-hmm. I think they probably just kind of disappear.
You know, I suspect that you're probably right about that. I hate to say it, but I think that you are right about that. And unfortunately, you know, this is what you describe in your book, Smear, is certainly not a perfect world, but it's I think advice and a guide on how to live in this environment that we are in, and how to recognize the spin and the smears when you see it. I want to ask, where do you think who's one of the biggest offenders of the smear in your mind?
Well, I talk about corporate interests and both Republican and Democrat interests. Everybody wants to be good at it. All sides are taking lessons from the other and developing their techniques and using the Internet. But Republicans and Democrats alike will point to David Brock, who was a smear artist who used to smear liberals. In fact, he used to smear the Clintons, and he's acknowledged and confessed to that. But then he switched sides, and now he smears conservatives or reporters who report facts that are uncomfortable to the people who support him. And he's developed this, you know, quite formidable empire, I call it, of LLCs, nonprofits, neutral-sounding watchdog organizations, groups that hire and train so-called reporters, pay reporters to write certain things that are then placed in news networks. I mean, all kinds of, you know, organizations. He gets paid millions and millions of dollars through that we've documented through these organizations he's built. And they appear, like any good smear organization, to have a broad reach and represent far more people than, in my view, they actually do, because it's really the same relatively small handful of interests using different names and different organizations that accomplish the same goals to give the AstroTurf appearance that everybody thinks a certain way. And that's the whole goal.
And I will tell you, Cheryl, there's a better than average chance that you're being watched by a David Brock minion right now, because we have our own Media Matters fellows who watch NRA TV each and every day and write about us.
I'm pretty sure I haven't, at least in the past, been assigned. And on the basis of this book, I'm sure I'm being assigned to have everything listened to. And I talk about this in the book, how they operate.
Mm-hmm.
How they assign people to listen to syllables and words and sentences and appearances and comb through tweets and to really search for anything that they can to try to controversialize and discredit the best way they can.
Yep, absolutely. Again, you can read more about this in the brand new book out today, The Smear, How Shady Political Operatives and Fake News Control What You See, What You Think, and how you vote. Cheryl, we've only got about a minute left, but let me ask you, and I know you've got a lot of advice for consumers of news in this book, but what's the one thing that we as consumers of news should keep in mind, and what's the best way that we can fight back against this?
When you see common narratives and phrases being used across the board by so many in social media, on the news, comedy channels, wherever you look, I think you have to at least consider the possibility that a narrative has taken hold that may not be true or may be exaggerated in terms of what people really think. Trust your cognitive dissonance. When you see and hear people say everybody knows X or Y, but you don't know it or you don't think it, trust your instincts and consider the possibility that someone is trying to shape or manipulate what you think for a further goal, and start thinking critically about why that might be and what it is they don't want you to know.
Cheryl Atkinson, the book is The Smear. Also, make sure you catch Full Measure with Cheryl Atkinson. What is the best way for folks to catch Full Measure, Cheryl?
Well, at fullmeasure.news, we have our list of TV stations under About, but you can watch it at fullmeasure.news anytime. It's a Sinclair product, and we post our shows and segments on there. So, hey, anytime for free, check
awesome.
It out.
Hey, Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us today. Best of luck with the new book, and hope we get a chance to do this again soon.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Cheryl Atkinson joining us from Full Measure, the book The Smear, out today.
All right, we're back.
It was out today, and this book is out now if you want to go to Amazon and buy it. It's The Smear by Cheryl Atkinson, and that was one of the best interviews so far.
That was a great interview. It's great to hear it again. Good idea there, Cameron.
All right, so we've got a break. You know, we talked about this coming into the segment. Let's talk about it a little bit more, and we'll talk more with Seton Motley about it. So this story, and Jesse and John, we were talking about this during the break. I get it that the CNN, the WWE Reddit story, and I understand it's huge news, and CNN really S'd the bed again.
Yeah.
And they deserve, and we'll talk about that too, they deserve everything they're getting right now. But this story out of Canada really needs a lot of attention, and thankfully Jesse Jane tweeted it, because she has a very large social media following. So a lot of people are seeing it through through Jesse's Twitter feed. But this story about Omar Khadr, this is from ABC News from yesterday. The lawyer for the widow of an American soldier killed in Afghanistan said Tuesday they have filed an application so that any money paid by the Canadian government to former Guantanamo Bay prisoner convicted of killing him will go towards the widow and another U.S. soldier injured. As Jesse said earlier, he was blinded. Lawyer Don Winder made the comments as a decision by the Canadian government to apologize and give millions of dollars to Omar Khadr came under mounting criticism. An official familiar with the deal said Tuesday that Khadr will receive $10.5 million Canadian dollars, which is $8 million U.S. The official was not authorized to discuss the deal publicly before the announcement spoke on the condition of anonymity. The government and Cotter's lawyers negotiated the deal last month. He pleaded to, in 2010 to charges that included murder, was sentenced to 8 years, plus the time he already spent in custody. He returned to Canada 2 years later to serve the remainder of his sentence and was released in May 2015, pending an appeal of his guilty plea, which he said was made under duress. The widow of Speer and Morris filed a wrongful death and injury lawsuit against Cotter in 2014, fearing Cotter might get his hands on the money from his $20 million wrongful imprisonment lawsuit. A U.S. judge granted $143 million in damages in 2015. And, you know, as we said earlier, he probably won't, they won't see a dime of this.
Let me give a little more clarification on this scumball. His lawyers were trying to suggest that he was just a victim of this bad daddy, Ahmed Syed Khadr, whose family stayed with Osama bin Laden. Okay? So this is rooted into this cat. You know, he was his Egyptian-born father was killed in 2003 when a Pakistani military helicopter shelled the house where they were staying with Al-Qaeda operatives. Nothing but freaking sleaze behind this guy. And I'm sorry, you know, just because your father was a criminal, you have got to make choices in life not to become a criminal. Right. Otherwise, you're still held accountable. But what this is even worse is that in 2015, when he was released from prison in Alberta, Omar Khadr apologized to the families of the victims. He says he rejects violent jihad and wants a fresh start to finish his education. You reject jihad, then you give it to those families.
Yep. Exactly.
That's
exactly.
Full remorse. Because right. if your God is what you want to have repentance for what your sin you have committed, then you show that. You give that money to those families.
And right now, the U.S. and Canada, there's some softwood lumber battles back and forth. There's always trade negotiations back and forth. This should be a topic that they should, you know, I can't see Canada giving in on this, but the Trump administration should take a hard line and say, listen, you know, there's going to be a trade deal affected by this. You know, we're going to take our money out of your ass somehow. We're going to get it, and we're going to get money and justice for this widow and for the family of the soldier who's blinded. I mean, something's got to give here. This is a story that, and I'm glad that the ABC story said it's under mounting criticism. This will just continue to get to be a bigger story, and hopefully, as more people pay attention to it here in the States. But this is a story that must be told and must be criticized and must be something's got to be done for justice.
Yeah, and after what he did, it didn't matter the age. As you said, murder is murder. He needs you to do the right thing. If you really
give that money back to the families.
Yep.
I mean, they can never get their loved ones back. And one was a medic. Yeah. You know, it wasn't somebody firing upon him. That's not. You can't declare this as self-defense. He killed a medic who was there to save lives, who would have saved his life had he been shot.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right, let's take a break. Colonel North's going to be calling in here in a minute. He's on a busy schedule. We're going to get to that, and we'll have more on this story, Cameron. Thanks for bringing it up, and Jesse Jane later in the program, later in the week. Up next, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North from Frontlines. We're going to talk to him about Independence Day, about our freedoms, and everything else.
And this story, too.
And this as well. Back with more of Cam & Company, fueled by Hornady. We'll be right back.
This actually is a gun that was very popular throughout the 18th century. It's a British all metal, what we call a black watch Scottish pistol. Normally, this would be made out of wood.
Yeah, that is pretty.
And here,
pretty different.
It's not. It's a beautiful metal. A lot of them sterling silver. You've got a very nice, elaborately engraved, faceted barrel. Beautiful little designs and flourishes on the hammer of the gun. It's a great little, no trigger guard.
I was going to say, that's some trigger on there, too.
Yeah, a nice little ball trigger. This is called a ram's head buttstock because it looks like, you know, the horns on a ram. And the neat thing is here we've got a, this piece detaches, and it's a frisson prick. You can clean out the gun with it.
That's very cool.
Yeah. So it's
a very fancy, ornate gun.
Yeah.
So who would be, back in the day, what would be the kind of person who would own a firearm like this? Was it functioning, but would something you use every day? Was it a showpiece? What was it?
Well, you see that there on this side, there's a belt hook. You can slide this over your belt, kind of doesn't need a holster. The most famous user of a pair of guns like this was Major John Pitcairn. We know his father, a famous explorer named Pitcairn Island out in the Pacific. But his son, John Pitcairn, is best known for being the British officer on the 19th of April in 1775 that ordered Captain John Parker at Lexington Green to throw down his arms. And Parker said, "Don't shoot until fired upon, but if they mean to have a war, let it begin here." And Pitcairn, leading those 300 British regulars that morning, had a brace of these guns.
I was a normal 20-year-old college student. When I moved into off-campus housing, they boasted that it was safe. Not a single incident since it had opened. I was the first. I woke up in the middle of the night, suffocating. "Shut up," he said. "Don't say a word." For the next 2 hours, I knew I was going to die, and there was nothing I could do. Now I'm a mother of two. And if that predator or anyone else tries to harm me or my family, they have to come through my firearm first. I will never be unarmed or utterly vulnerable ever again. The only reason I can say that is because the NRA fought for my rights before I ever knew that I needed them. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I grew up on the south side of Chicago. You know it as one of the most dangerous cities in America. I know it as something less than America, a place where the law doesn't matter. It's illegal for criminal gang members, drug dealers, and felons to even touch a gun. Chicago's politicians could clean the streets tomorrow just by enforcing that federal law. But they would rather attack the gun rights of good people than crack down on the violent criminals who terrorize them. So law-abiding Southsiders put their kids to bed to the sound of gunfire, with no hope but to pray it doesn't come closer. Chicago's injustice is America's problem. Either we fight this cancer of corruption, or we pray it doesn't come closer. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
And we're back here with Cam and Company, fueled by Hornery. Hornady, you know, Hornady, we're really on NRA TV. Here's XM Patriot 125.
That's Hornady.
I'm just going to stop talking today.
By Hornady
it's
today.
It's your fault, Jesse Dane. You have me flustered, okay?
Yeah, and I know what you really wanted to say, because I'm here.
We'll leave it there.
We'll leave it there.
Family friendly.
Let's get right to Colonel North, who's been holding. Colonel North, welcome to Cam and Company. How are you, sir?
It's great to be back with you guys again. I wish I could be in studio, but unfortunately, I'm locked in at Fox.
Ah,
oh,
very
boy.
Good.
Yeah, well, they do it. Send me a nice paycheck. Pay me a lot more to get shot at than the Marine Corps ever did. So I'm...
Oh, wow. Hook your fellow Marine up there, Colonel.
There you go. There
come
you go
on.
Again.
The gunny is needing yeah. some money. Come on, hook me up. Yeah, hook the girl up.
Gunny money.
Colonel, let me start with a topic that we've talked about the last couple hours here. I'm sure you've been following the story out of Canada, the story of Omar Khadr. The former Guantanamo Bay resident who sued the country of Canada, the Supreme Court decided, the U.S. did you wrong. They got your confession under duress, and now he has $10 million Canadian dollars, $8 million American dollars, and he says he's a changed man and he rejects jihad. And as Jesse Jane suggested, well then give that money up, because the family of he killed an army medic, he blinded another soldier, and they're suing him, and they sued ahead of time, anticipating a verdict like this, a stunning, horrible verdict like this, and they were right to do so because he was awarded $8 million, and they're probably not going to get a dime of this across the border. When you see a story like this, Ali, what do you think?
Well, you know, this is the kind of thing that makes everybody wonder who our real allies are.
Hmm.
I mean, I can see now Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, putting in for his chit so he can get a Canadian court to do this kind of thing.
Right.
Look, we've had Americans jailed overseas by regimes that they changed their minds about things like rendition. We've had American U.S. government officials jailed for those kinds of things, threatened with jail in other cases by these international courts. And what good ever came from this kind of judgment. I think it's absolutely right. There's never going to be a payout from America, but it probably means that anybody connected to that lawsuit can't go to Canada anymore and spend money.
Huh. But if you were a member of the Trump administration, would you take a hard line on this? Because as we talked about, there's trade imbalances all the time. We're talking about softwood lumber right now. There's always trade back and forth. Would you make this a condition of a trade deal or do something else to say, listen, you're going to give us this money?
It certainly ought to be. I mean, look at the kinds of things that we've done to get Canadian hostages out of Afghanistan and out of Iraq. I mean, it's not like the Americans have been out there perpetrating all these terrible crimes that this judge has suddenly decided he's now going to in charge of punishing Americans.
Hey, Semper Fi, Colonel. This is Gunny. How are you?
God love you, Guns. How are you?
Oh, I love you, too. But you don't follow me on Twitter. It hurts my feelings.
Oh, Ollie.
I just wanted to call you out on that.
I must tell you.
You don't manage your account. Okay.
Well, no, I occasionally look at it.
Ollie's not a big tweeter.
I just posted on both Twitter and on Facebook that I'm going to be on three more times today before I get to go home.
It's just a sign of love. That's
Ollie, you missed Snapchat. Where are you? All the kids are doing Snapchat.
Yeah. Oh, God, don't do Snapchat, Colonel. You'll see things you haven't seen in a very long time.
You don't have to worry about it.
I'm just letting you know. I mean, I saw a lot in the core. I'm pretty salty. I can handle it. But, you know, you were an officer. We kind of protected you from viewing some of those little things.
I'm just glad they didn't have it back, 30 years ago.
Oh, my God.
In fact, it's 30 years ago this week that I made my television debut. Oh. I was invited to chat with a number of, I was subpoenaed.
Oh,
it was 30 years ago this week.
Yeah. Wow.
I remember I was based in Okinawa, and you were just like a hero to us. We just were like rooting for you. We just we just get excited to see a Marine on television in the first place. And back then, there wasn't social media. So I was looking at you at, what was it, FEN, the Far East Network, back in the day. That's all we had. We didn't even have computers. I know a lot of the people are going, how old is she? I'm sorry, I was 12 at the time. I just But with that said, I remember that so well, and you just were like this legend. We just loved you, and I know you didn't feel it because it was a very duressful and stressful time for you.
The response of the American people, in large part because the Commandant of the Marine Corps ordered me to wear my uniform. I didn't want to put the Marine Corps through what I knew was coming. And he called me up the night before and said, and I was working right straight down the hall from him, that I would go over every afternoon to prepare with the wonderful man who was not a potted plant who sat next to me for all of this. And the commandant called me up that night and said, so what are you wearing tomorrow morning? I said, well, I was going to wear civilian clothes. He said, this is General Kelly, a commandant of the Marine Corps. And I was literally right down on the second deck of the old Marine headquarters building up there on the hill. And he said, when I testify, I wear my uniform. I expect all of my Marines to wear their uniform. What are you wearing tomorrow?
I may be
a little slow, but I picked right up on that one.
And it worked because the American public doesn't want to ever see a man or woman who is serving their country, let alone as many decades as you had, sitting up there and being exonerated by these fools in Congress and Senate who have never even walked by a recruiter's office or have downplayed the service that we have done. We just find that reprehensible and disgusting. We don't really give a darn what you did. As far as we're concerned, you're a good man and get him the hell out of there. That's the way the American public felt about it. It's like, I'm sorry, that's a United States Marine. And what did you do for this country, Congressman?
Hey, Jess, I want you to start handling my PR.
Right? She's amazing, Ollie.
I'm telling you, follow me on Twitter. I'll do anything for you. Just letting you know. I might have just got a whole lot of followers right now. That was not an open invitation to everybody.
Ollie North only.
Yeah. This is between me and the colonel talking now, But he knows the Gunny doesn't take any crap, I'm just not going to put up with that kind of nonsense. And back then, I was just, I believe I had picked up corporal meritoriously. God knows they only had an extra spot. That's why I got it. I mean, it was one of those boards where they're like, well, she came in last, but we actually have another spot, so she got it. I think I was 19 at the time. And, I just gave away my age. Anyway, with that upset. Back to this situation with Canada, what's so upsetting for all of us is that we, the American people, have to get this out there. And if you have an opportunity at any given time, if you can, Fox actually did put a story out on it, and I think that they should cover it a little more extensively, because this is a slap in the face to every American who has served this country. And we sit here, and if it weren't for the United States of America, Canada would have been invaded a hell of a lot long time ago. That's what it boils down to. We are standing up for all of the Northern American countries. We represent the freedom that they, the blanket of freedom that they sleep under.
The fact is that in the aftermath of what the North Koreans did on our Independence Day, the Canadians ought to be very concerned, because, yeah, the missile might be able to hit Alaska, but if that's an ICBM with an electromagnetic pulse warhead, an EMP warhead, it could shut Canada down for 3 years without electricity. And it gets pretty dark in northern Canada.
And cold.
And cold in the middle of winter with no electricity. Think about it. And the Canadians, to a person, understand that their Liberal government has brought them this. And so they can turn it around a lot faster than we'll be able to. But I sure don't think any American dollars are ever going to go to this guy.
No. Ali, I know you have limited time, and let's keep it in Canada real quick. We talked earlier. I brought up this notion I was discussing. I was watching the Canada 150 celebrations, which was Canada Day was on the 1st.
Yeah.
And the CBC, which you know is notoriously leftist, their coverage was so tortured because they were so – they felt so bad about Canada's past, and we have to have a nod to the Indigenous peoples and the First Nations, and they're not happy with us. And there was so much back and forth about, yeah, it's our birthday, but we're kind of a crappy country, and we did bad things, and, you know, take your celebrations with a grain of salt, because we did the wrong thing by people. And Jesse made this point very well, that thankfully, you know, we were going that direction here in the United States. And it seems that after the election of President Trump, when patriotism is at a much higher level than the previous 8 years, we were going in that direction towards America's a bad country. America did bad things. America was a colonizing occupier. What do you do, and what do you say about this country to people like that, to say, listen, this is a great country. You know, we never want to go down that road of a Canada and feeling bad about ourselves as a country.
But, you know, look, Canada is just like most of Europe right now.
Right.
I mean, this is almost a copycat of where Western Europe has come. And every once in a while, we need to remind people, like the Europeans right now, the big G20 summit that's going to happen to start tomorrow. Mm-hmm. We need to remind them that over a million young Americans died in three wars in that part of the world. I say three because it's World War I, World War II, and the Cold War. And the United States of America came and bailed them out from despotism, and we stopped the Soviets from invading the rest of Europe. And the idea that somehow we have to apologize for who we are and what we've done and the remarkable freedoms. I read the Declaration of Independence last night to a church group out in Percival, Virginia, at St. Peter's Church. 1,337 words. That it's the only document of its kind in any national manuscript that pays homage to God Almighty. If you say those kinds of things in Canada today, you risk being literally called out for some kind of crime against humanity,
right,
because you've professed your Christian faith. I mean, that's how bad things have gotten. And quite frankly, I think the backlash was the election of last November. I think the American people had just about had enough of it. And all those kinds of things where America was going to... How did Obama begin his term 8 years ago? He began it with the Grand
World
Apology Tour,
right,
all over the Middle East.
Right.
And look what we've got for it.
All right. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, Frontlines on NRA TV, over at Fox News now. We're going to let you get back to
it. He's got 20 more appearances to do by the end of the day.
Yes.
But this was your favorite. This was your favorite, Colonel. You can
God
admit
love
it.
You guys.
All right. Thank
all right,
you, Colonel.
Thank you, sir.
Semper Fi.
Look after him, Gunny. Semper Fi.
I will.
She does.
Good luck with that one. Try to keep us, you know.
You can't even run as fast as me. Don't even try getting away.
No, I'm just going to crawl under the table.
I'll just tackle you.
Yeah, and Cameron, you protect me, okay?
Yeah, right.
Oh, please.
Good luck.
All right, let's take a quick break, and the next, Seton Motley from Less Government joins us. We've got a lot more coming up in this Wednesday edition of Cam & Company. It's NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125, iHeartRadio, and we're all fueled by Hornady. We'll be right back. Speaking with Ben Trout, he is the VP of Customer Service and Guest Experience with Bristol Motor Speedway. Ben, welcome to the program. I am so excited not just to talk to you, but to talk about the race. So let's talk about the race. What's the official name of the night race, Ben? Go ahead.
Hey, John. First of all, thanks for having us on today. And, yeah, of course, it is the ever-popular Bass Pro Shops NRA night race right here at Bristol Motor Speedway. And it's going to be one wonderful time. It's on the bucket list of so many race fans out there.
Yeah, I know.
And it's that night race is just a wonderful sight to see.
It's a classic already. Bristol is just, you know, a great track in so many ways. And then as good as this all is, then you have Bass Pro Shops and the NRA involved in the night race. And then, as if that's not enough, let's talk a little bit first about the whole thing that's happening with Dale, with Junior. What's going on?
Yeah, so as we all learned, and it was really interesting because Dale Earnhardt Jr. made the announcement the Tuesday following our spring race, our Food City 500.
Right.
And he comes out and he tells the world that, hey, at the completion of the 2017 season, I'm going to hang him up.
Yeah, which
I'm going to retire.
Shocked a lot of people. It was big news everywhere when he made that announcement.
John, it was huge news, and it really has impacted the racing world. So for fans that have an affinity for not just Dale Jr. but the Earnhardt name and the impact that the Earnhardt name has made on racing throughout three generations, they'll get a chance to see Dale Jr. race not once but twice. He'll be racing in the Xfinity Series Food City 300 on Friday night. But then, of course, on Saturday night, it's the big show. It's the Bass Pro Shops NRA night race. And we'll see if Dale Jr. can dial it back to 2004 when he actually won that race here at Bristol Motor Speedway.
How great Ben is.
If he can do it again.
Everyone's going to be rooting for him to win the race. So we're talking about the Bass Pro Shops NRA night race. It's Saturday, August 19th coming up. And also the other race you mentioned on Friday that, well, because what I'm leading to, Ben, is you don't just want to come down for the race. A lot of people come down race week. There's so much stuff going on. Just give us an idea. Paint a little picture, Ben, of all the stuff that happens around the race during race week.
Hey, John, words can't do it justice. So that's the unique thing about Bristol race week. And a lot of times that's how we refer to it. We don't refer to it as a race weekend. We literally here in the halls and even in our communication to race fans, we call it August race week. We actually have a full package of on-track action and some great off-track events. So really the on-track stuff starts on Wednesday, and we have two races, not just one, but we have two. We have the UNOH 200 Camping World Truck Series, and then the what's a really unique race to see is the Busch's Beans 150 NASCAR Wheel and Modified Series race, all on Wednesday.
Right.
And so that, you know, we see people arrive here a week ahead of time, sometimes in some cases 2 weeks ahead of time. They get to, you know, the beautiful hills of Northeast Tennessee. They go visit our lakes and streams, or they drive down to the Pigeon Forge, Sevierville area. Just a lot of wonderful things to do here within the area. And a lot of our fans make literally make vacation out of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right before you hit that back to school time,
yep.
We see a lot of families roll in and they camp out and just have a lot of fun.
So before we run out of time,
yeah.
So we have the races on Friday and Saturday, and then Thursday night is the annual Fitzgerald Peterbilt Transporter Parade. That is so cool. Take about 30 seconds to tell us what that is.
Yeah, it's great. It's about so there's a place called the Pinnacle out near Exit 74 on I-81. And all of the haulers, the multi-million-dollar haulers that travel the NASCAR, the actual cars around from track to track, we line them up about 10 miles away from the speedway, and they make a trip down Highway 11E, or as most people around here, we refer to it as Volunteer Parkway. And we do, from about four different locations, we shoot fireworks high above the haulers, and it has become a true Bristol tradition.
and they will do that again on that Thursday night of race week.
Ben Trout, Bristol Motor Speedway. Get more information, call 423-BRISTOL or go to NRARaceTix.com, code B17NRA. Ben Trout, thank you so much. Look forward to seeing you race week. Thank you, sir.
Hey, thanks, and we'll talk to you soon.
And we're back. Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, John Pop, Cameron Gray, Jesse Jane Duff here. And we should have just done it, Cameron, just during the Colonel North interview, just left and let
we
Jesse Jane
we
handle it.
We were just a fly on the wall. We were eye candy at that point.
No, I'm the eye candy. Don't you ever forget
at that point, we were.
Yes.
Like, if you don't get to watch this, just keep in mind, I come looking good. Just
yes,
let me know.
Does.
Where's the push-up bras and everything?
She brings her A-game every time, ladies and gentlemen. And speaking of bringing his A-game, our good friend Seton Motley. Seton, welcome, sir. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing great.
Seton, your article came at fortuitous timing because we've Jesse Jane tweeted this. I've been following the story, and I'm glad she tweeted this, and I'm sure you're following it, too. The story out of Canada, Omar Khadr, who got $10 million Canadian dollars out of the government up there after serving time in Guantanamo after killing an army medic and blinding another soldier. And your article in Red State, the media left's uber-fringe, terrorist-loving July 12th day of traction, you talk about a lot of these terrorists. And the one thing that I'm about this article that I'm glad you talked about was Assata Shakur, who is one of the most horrific people in a recent American history. He killed a New Jersey state trooper in the 70s. She's now hiding out in Cuba. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they'll ever get her out of there. But and the thing that drives me crazy about this is you see a lot of these Black Lives Matter marches, these anti-cop marches, and a lot of them, you know, they chant her telling of the phrase, the only thing we have to lose is our chains. And they hold her up as this conquering hero and this amazing activist. She killed a cop.
And grievously wounded another.
Right.
And not just by accident. There was a shootout on the highway.
Yeah.
And she killed a cop and really badly wounded someone else. And the reason I wrote about her, the reason she came up is July 12th is coming up, and that's a good day for me and Cameron, but it's a,
that's right. Jay,
it's
for
a
people
bad
don't know,
day for
this. See, Seton Motley and I have the exact same birth date, July 12th, 1971. So we'll always have that karmic connection.
Oh, Lord.
That's exactly right. But these idiots line this thing up. And what it is they're protesting the Trump administration rightly, reasonably rolling back the Obama administration's power grab on the internet, where they classified it under 1934 landline phone law and then imposed net neutrality. It's a huge power grab. It needs to go away. Thankfully, Trump and Chairman Ajit Pai of the SEC are doing it. And they're going through the normal channels, and it takes a while and all that. So they've organized this rally. And the person who's organizing the rally, the main funder of it is Amazon and a bunch of other Silicon Valley companies.
Right.
The main organizer of this thing is a guy by the name of Evan Greer. And Evan Greer is everything you think of when you think of radical leftist idiot. He calls himself a queer music activist, something or other. I can't remember what he wrote on his website. I put it in the piece. And
let me quote it because it's so good. I'm a queer activist, singer, songwriter, organizer, parent, speaker, and workshop facilitator in Boston. Workshop facilitator being the most egregious part because those people are useless.
It makes community organizers look
right. That's the minor leagues of community organizing. Workshop facilitator.
Work your way up from workshop facilitator.
Facilitator.
So this guy is the organizer, and in his illustrious career prior to organizing this nonsense and getting funded big time, I'm sure, by Amazon and a bunch of other companies, who, by the way, benefit. The reason they're funding this is because net neutrality outlaws them being charged for all the bandwidth they use. Mm-hmm. So, of course, they want net neutrality kept in place. But Evan Greer spent 2.5 years working, and I can't pronounce this guy's name off the top of my head. Can you look at the first guy I mentioned in the piece?
The first guy you mentioned the piece, Tariq Mahana?
That's it.
Tariq Mahana, yep.
who was an ISIS collaborator in the United States. And he and Evan Greer spent 2.5 years of his life trying to get him out of prison.
Jeez.
Then he also loves, for instance, the FALN.
Lopez Rivera. who is
Lopez Rivera, the Puerto Rican terrorist who blows stuff up in New York City and elsewhere.
And that was in the news recently because he was honored at the Puerto Rican Day parade in the down Manhattan, and until the very last minute. Mayor de Blasio was going to be with him. Exactly. He did the march, but he decided, hey, listen, I'm getting so much pushback. I'm not going to go with him. But the speaker of the New York City Council, I think it was Viverto, she was more than into him. And the thing that really drives you crazy is, and John mentioned Hamilton earlier. I have no use for Hamilton, but that guy, Lin-Manuel, he was ecstatic this day, this terrorist was released. He said, I'm going to do a special showing of Hamilton for you. It'd be an honor to have you. I mean, and this guy Lin-Manuel, it's like as mainstream as it gets. Now. He gets Disney deals, and he's beaming. He's on top of cloud nine because Oscar Lopez Rivera was released. That's gross.
And please let's remember all this.
Hello.
Oh, please. Uh-huh. But then we get to Miss Shakur.
No.
And this to me, of all the stupid things that I found in my brief bit of research on Evan Greer, this was the most offensive to me because he tweeted about Miss Shakur that she's okay or she should be freed and exonerated because she didn't even hurt a civilian.
I mean,
hurt a civilian. She killed a cop.
Right.
And wounded another. And so anyway, this is Evan Greer. This is the guy organizing the July 12th day of action, which I call the day of traction, because if these regulations are kept in place, the internet will stop moving. So this is the guy that all these allegedly mainstream companies are funding. Mm-hmm. This is the guy that the media is, if you read all the articles, I linked to, I believe, five. But there's 105 of them out there, of these media articles that treat this thing as a normal protest organized by normal people. Yeah. And it is not even close to being that.
Well, and the other thing, too, is you talk about normal protests being treated treated as normal by the MSM. Look at Women's March. Look at the people involved with Women's March, some of the most far-left radicals that you could imagine. And, you know, they recently called out the NRA. But they had Madonna was on stage at the Women's March talking about blowing up the White House. Linda Sarsour, who's one of the co-founders, she's anti-Jewish as it gets. You had Donna Hilton, who was a convicted murderer. You had Ramzi Odeh, a convicted Palestinian terrorist. These are the people that they bring up to speak at these, and people cover these marches. Like I saw these articles, you know, after the NRA, the Women's March went off the NRA, and they said even the Women's March is talking about this as if they get some sort of mainstream traction because they call themselves the Women's March. They're allowed to become this entity that people need to take seriously. They have speaking at their conferences literal killers, and they're trying to talk about other people. Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And trying to pitch it off as representing women is what's so abhorrent to me. And the media is not saying that. They're just basically classifying all women as of one thinking. And that is just like, what in the heck?
But not all women, because they said specifically, if you are a
pro-life
woman, we have no use for you. So it's a woman's march with an asterisk.
Right.
Well, and of course, I'd like to harken back to 2009 or 2010 when the Barack Obama administration, DHS, came out with the number one domestic terror threat is right-wing groups.
Right, of course.
Oh,
and they have multiple murderers, you know, a
convoline
of murderers speaking at left-wing events.
I believe Janet Napolitano had made a reference to veterans, as I recall,
I think
too.
You're right.
I'm fuzzy on that one, but I do remember that.
No, she did. It was a backdoor shot. She said, you know, they all suffer from post-traumatic stress, and they should have their guns taken.
Well, who wouldn't suffer from post-traumatic stress after the last 8 years?
I think every
American has it now.
And anyone who comes by into personal contact with Napolitano.
Oh, wow, my goodness, of course. You know.
So, see, people hear this story, and, you know, you see Amazon buying Whole Foods, and you see them pretty much taking over the world, which I'm sure you're thrilled with.
Speaking of media, Amazon owns Washington Post.
Exactly. You know, is there people watching, listening right now, what can they do about this? Well, other than bring it up to people's attention and share it, is there anything that can be done?
Yeah, well, you and I have talked about this. I don't use any Google products, for example, because they're the evil empire. You know, I don't use their email. I don't use their documents. I don't use anything. You know, I don't shop at Whole Foods. Remember when the libertarian president of Whole Foods wrote the anti-minimum wage article, I think is what he wrote?
Yes, I think so.
And they did the left wing did a boycott.
Yep.
So the right wing did a boycott, and those were some of the funniest tweets I've ever seen.
Right.
Where they said, "I've never seen so many people wandering around Whole Foods lost."
You know, and it's funny now. You know, there's these stories have been coming out in the last couple of weeks of the perils and the fallacy of the minimum wage laws. And you, as the head of less government, have got to be interested and happy to see the chickens coming home to roost when it comes to that story.
I don't like to see people. No, I don't like to see people losing their jobs.
No, no, not losing their job, but proving that the these artificial minimum wage hikes are bad.
Jobs with a higher minimum wage, and you know, look. It's so frustrating because I feel like I'm watching a movie for the 50th time. I mean, we've all made these mistakes before, and we seem rigidly insistent on making them again. Yes, anyone who can do math, I knew them. You know, those of us who can do math knew the minimum wage was going to be a problem. You know, I've also always said, if you're waiting around for the government to get you a raise, you're doing it wrong.
right.
The government can't price fix, whether it's wages, whether it's, you know, the cost of gas, whether it's anything. They can't do it.
One of the articles I read recently indicated that youth is no longer taking on a lot of part-time jobs because they're volunteering, they're doing internships, and it totally avoided. The reality is nobody's going to hire a high school kid anymore to work at McDonald's. They're going to hire somebody who's got an associate's degree. Because if I've got to pay $15 an hour, you're going to have to walk in that door with a little bit more life experience.
A factor of this, too, is widespread illegal immigration. Because they can hire a 35-year-old.
Yes.
Why would they hire a 15-year-old?
Exactly. And that's exactly – they have a lot of unintended consequences, or maybe they were intended.
No one breaks the law of unintended consequences more than government.
That's true.
We retweeted your article.
Yeah, I'm on your article.
The media left's Uber Fringe terrorist-loving July 12th day attraction at Cam & Company. Happy early birthday, pal.
Hey, same to you, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Seton.
Thank you,
Seton.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
Guffman. Do you guys have, like, special get-together, you
no,
two?
No, but I thought it was very cool. I've always had a very soft spot in my heart for Seton.
He's awesome, but how great is that? I didn't really get the
exact
same,
day.
Birthday.
Exact
same day. Not just that day
the
of the
day
year.
Day and year.
Do you have the same father?
With my dad.
Are you actually twins?
With my dad, who knows?
Are you twins? You can admit it.
Well, to look at the two of them, you could easily make that mistake.
No.
Okay.
No.
No, no,
no.
No. That's it for this hour
Who's
of Cam
&
Company.
Daddy?
More coming up in the next.
Who's yours?
In the next hour.
Yeah, I got a few.
We'll replay.
Spin the wheel of.
Why don't I even try? Next hour, we'll replay Glenn Jacobs with Cam, WWE Superstar Kane,
yes.
Miles Hall of Hall & Hall Consulting, and Stephen Cruiser all coming up. Please, just everyone take a breath.
I'll be back.
Go get a glass of water, a soda pop, and get ready for hour three of Cam & Company, fueled by Hornady. We'll be right back.
What this program will do is it will take you from somebody who has a gun and might have a gun on your hip to somebody who is proficient in using that gun.
I would say I'm still in the beginner's phase in a sense that I didn't really start doing any official training, going to classes until about a year ago.
If I were to put it on a scale of 1 to 10 as far as proficiency, I would say I'm under 5. That will change because I have made that decision to become as proficient as possible.
With a handgun, I've got a lot more experience, so I'm a little bit better shot. With a rifle, Caitlin is a better shot because of all the experience she has had.
I've been fortunate enough to do a lot of shooting and be in units that have done a lot of shooting. So when it comes to the legality of it, the responsibility of it, and then when it comes to the actual physical training, I think it's awesome.
I have a lot of experience with firearms, but from high-level instructors, they just have infinite knowledge, and it's really nice to learn from people like them.
You know, I've done some classes before, but these guys really break it down into every little step so that you're able to really hone in every little movement.
They all have similar backgrounds, but the diversity in each of them and the stories and experiences they've all had are ideal for someone like myself to walk into this experience.
Oh my gosh, it's definitely a once-in-a-lifetime experience getting training from these amazing guys out here. gotten so much more out of this than a couple weeks of shooting on my own.
There's things that I've done that are fast. There's things I've done that look good. There's things I've done that work in certain scenarios. These guys are teaching a way that works every time. The heavy burden that you carry, carrying, was where I learned the most.
The right responsibilities is probably one of the more important parts of what you can learn.
On the range and off the range, you know, just knowing what the laws are, how we need to think, the mindset that we need if you are carrying a gun, that it is a big responsibility.
A lot of that information was eye-opening to me, and I hadn't heard it instructed that way, I hadn't heard it presented that way, so it was very educational.
You can always go to the range and shoot at paper, but this class brought in different elements that you don't always do, like low-light shooting.
Statistically, things happen mostly after dark when you would need to use your firearm, and so that's a really important skill that I need to have.
With Airsoft, it really helped wrap the whole training experience together, brought the adrenaline level up, the realness of the scenario.
I think it's the best way to learn. I think you can tell somebody something so many times, and you can look at it on paper so many times, but until you get that real tactile response and that adrenaline and that situational scenario, there's no better way to learn.
When the whistle hit and Derek started running, when I pulled out my gun out of my holster and shot, you could see the distance that he got on me, and that's such a huge reality check.
So as parents, this class is really great. The more tools that we have, you know, to protect our kids and our family, I think the better.
This program is great for everyone. I think it's great for someone like me that's carried a long time and had a lot of shooting experience. And I think it's great for someone that's coming in, and this may be the only class they take.
Made in America since 1949. Family owned and operated. Legendary performance. This is Hornady. You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
We're back with Hour 3 of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. John Pop, Cameron Gray, and Jesse Jane Duff filling in for Cam for a few days here. And we're going to hear from Cam here in just a moment. But Cameron, first, what do you have, sir?
So I know it's Blame Canada Day here on South Park TV.
And we're sorry to all of our fans yes, up in Canada.
Right, exactly. There's plenty of people listening, especially on SiriusXM Patriots 124. We appreciate that for sure. But, you know, this is a story that, just like the Omar Khadr story, guys, this is, especially the day after it happened, this story dropped like a rock. Does anybody remember a week or two ago, a man at the airport in Flint, Michigan, went right behind a cop, yelled "Allahu Akbar," and stabbed the guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
Have you seen that story since?
No.
That story is gone. That story disappeared almost instantly. This guy, and I bring it up about Canada because he was a Canadian citizen, and he tried to buy a gun here in the States, and that didn't work because he's not an American citizen. So there's news, and as for much crap as I'll give CNN, especially right now with the CNN blackmail hashtag and all the nonsense with the Trump videos, CNN breaking news, you know, put the story out. Man accused of stabbing an officer while yelling "Allahu Akbar" at the Flint, Michigan airport has been indicted. And I've been watching ever since. And they talked about this guy a week ago. When he was the charges were released, no one's talking about the story. And this is, you know, it's a horrible story. Canadian man has been indicted in a stabbing attack last month in the Flint, Michigan airport. Omar Fatoui, 49, faces charges of committing an act of violence at an international airport and interference with airport security. Authorities say he stabbed Bishop International Airport Police Lieutenant in the neck with a knife on June 21st. Fatoui referenced killings in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, yelled "Allahu Akbar" while stabbing the uniformed officer, and the United States said the United States Attorney General for the Eastern District of Michigan. The charges carry a maximum penalty of life in prison. You know, this is – he yelled "Allahu Akbar" in Arabic. He used a roughly 12-inch knife with an 8-inch serrated blade to stab Lieutenant Jeff Neville.
Jeez.
After stabbing Neville, Fatui continued to yell Allah several times, followed by something similar to, "You have killed people in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and we are all going to die." Lieutenant Neville got him to stop stabbing him, said Chief Chris Miller of the Bishop Airport Safety Division, who was nearby during the attack and handcuffed Fatui. So charges for him, indictment for him, which is great. But like the Omar Khadr story, another Canadian citizen, this story, you know, it's the narrative busting story, which we know mm-hmm. why it's mm-hmm. not gone anywhere. But this is a story that it's an attack on a police officer in an airport in our country, and it just went away.
Many of these stories are getting distracted, sadly, because the media doesn't want to focus on them. They want to focus on the victimization of them by the president because they have blasted him for so long, and now that he's fighting back, that's the story they want. They're now the victim. They're not talking about what's going on in the Middle East. They're not talking about the trip. They're talking
well,
on
as
a
Ali
level.
Said, North Korea.
Right.
You know, they fired ICBM the other day.
Right.
I mean, dangerous
stuff.
Right. On
Independence
stuff.
Day. They right. picked Independence Day to fire this. And it's really just when you look at their priorities on the time, I believe that CNN is focused on Donald Trump's tweeting probably like 10, 20 times more
it's a
than anything
amount.
Else. Mm. You go to the economy and they're not talking about it. Nothing else, because all they're trying to save themselves. And the best thing that they can do is pretend to be the victim of what this horrible presidency has created in their minds. And instead, Americans are being robbed of real news. And honestly, they need to just stop. Just start reporting the news. Like today, when you did that, I'm thinking to myself, I'd love to tweet that out, but I know my followers will be going, it's CNN, fake news. And they don't
want
to reach it.
That's a problem too. That's
yeah,
a problem too.
They're getting, but they've labeled themselves that way now.
I'll grant you that. But at the same time, Jesse,
the story has to get out.
At the same time, Jesse Jane, I have no use for people who out of hand reject everything CNN said just because. Listen, CNN has screwed up royally recently, and they're doing it every day. But that doesn't negate everything CNN reports.
I agree.
And I have a huge problem with people on our side saying, well, that came from CNN. That's fake news.
Agree.
That's got to be stopped too.
Oh, I agree. I'm with you 150%, and that.
And I hold no water for CNN, but I'm not going to say you can't just paint
right.
everyone with a broad
right.
brush like that.
I agree with you. And I just would have, and what they have to do now is concentrate on these stories and start redeeming their legitimacy and just keep plugging it and plugging it and plugging it. And
wait,
just,
you mean trying to find the identity of the Reddit poster who put a fake WWE meme
oh,
up? You think that's not the top story in the world
right
now?
Right.
What the hell's wrong with you, Duff?
Well, you know, the thing is, that's an interesting story to me because Andrew Kaczynski, I've gone after him for some time now. He's taken out
K-File for people on
Twitter. K-File.
Yeah,
yeah, his Twitter handle is at K-File because that's what they call his team that does these hack jobs. There are two other people prior to Monica Crowley and Sheriff Clark, and they were hatchet jobs. They went after them brutally to remove them from the Trump administration. There are two other people. He has disrupted many lives with these assaults where it's not based upon what these people could provide for this country or their legitimacy in their capabilities. And when this dropped on him with this CNN blackmail,
yeah.
I was elated because now he got so cocky, he thought he could go after the president. And the Trump supporters are going
to... But that's the thing.
He
and CNN, this whole team, are trying to go after the president by going after some nobody who
exactly.
happened to post a wrestling thing as if everyone who tweets a picture is responsible for everything that person's ever made before. It's nonsense.
But not only that, and then blackmailing him that he needs to square away his ways or they'll expose him. That is, now it's out. But had he just gone after you or me, it'd still be one of those things where just people don't like him. Now I would not be surprised if he has to be fired now. Because the fact
it's putting CNN in a bad place.
It's putting him in a bad place that he blackmailed somebody. But if it wasn't connected
to President... Let's be careful because words matter. Let's be careful. He didn't blackmail this person. Let's be careful. I don't want to get back on it. Let's
CNN.
Be careful. Well, see, they had words in their article that were of a blackmailing nature. They were like,
absolutely.
Hey, listen, you act right. Or you're going to get in trouble. I don't want to throw out the word he blackmailed me. We should be careful.
That's
but
true.
They did some really shady crap. that you're right. I think that, you know, after there was an erroneous Russia report recently and three people were fired because of that, you see these James O'Keefe videos. I mean, they just keep piling up.
Right.
You don't
James
even need James O'Keefe anymore.
They're doing
it to themselves.
They're doing it to themselves. James O'Keefe, some of the stuff that guy was saying about, you know, what he said about Kellyanne, you know.
Face with a shovel.
Right. And the voters are stupid. They're stupid. You're just like, my gosh, this looks like a Hillary.
And it's funny. I know we got to do this tape, but it's funny because people will defend it by saying, it was a low-level producer in Atlanta, whatever. If the tiniest producer that you've ever passed at Fox News were to say anything bad, like let's say Michelle was Obama's in office, pitchforks and torches
fired.
In front of Fox News office.
Fox News did fire Bob Beckel for saying something to an IT professional. It wasn't even caught on camera.
Okay.
But he had made a comment that was perceived, it was racist. There was an African American working on his computer. He made a comment. Boom, he was out. That is it. And it wasn't even on camera. Why would you even allow it to be where now you're forced to have to let people go? Why aren't you doing what is right immediately? Immediately when James O'Keefe came out, they instead of circling the wagons like they did, they should have immediately come out and said, we are letting these people go. Clean house.
Yeah. Well, and them not doing it, now it's compounded because you have this, you have the CNN blackmail story, which is getting worse by the hour for them.
Yes.
It's a mess.
It's nonstop.
Yes.
All right. Well, Cam's out for a couple of days, 2-3 days here. We're going to play back some of the highlights, the best interviews from 2017 so far.
Yes.
Cameron, what do we have now?
So we're lucky here on Cam and Company. Glenn Jacobs, who's also known as Kane, is a fan of our show. He listens,
is awesome.
Which is cool. A good friend who's become a good friend of mine, Larry Heck, who's one of the athletic trainers at the WWE, these guys drive a lot from show to show. And, show ends late. Our show is on at midnight Eastern on Sirius XM Patriot. And they catch a lot of the show every night. And they've brought me backstage. You've met them in Atlanta. And they're very good people. And Kane, Glenn Jacobs, is a very smart libertarian. A couple weeks ago, there was a story about this wrestling heel, the bad guy, who's calling himself the progressive liberal. And he's wearing a Hillary shirt. The clip is in this interview. It's fantastic. And Kane himself was running for mayor in Tennessee. So it was just a fantastic, interesting interview.
All right, take a look and a listen.
And right now, very pleased to have with us on the program, at Glenn Jacobs TN on Twitter. You know him, you love him as Glenn Jacobs, also as Kane. Glenn, how are you, sir?
Doing fantastic. How are you guys?
I am great. I appreciate you coming on the program. We've been talking wrestling this afternoon because I got a kick out of this story about the wrestling heel known as the Progressive Liberal who is wrestling in the Appalachian Wrestling League right now.
Yeah, someone sent me that link. I was like, wow, it's it's definitely definitely in my neck of the woods. He would be a not too savory character, let me put it that way.
Right. Well, he talked about how he, the heat as soon as he walks out in his Hillary Clinton T-shirt and he starts mocking the crowd. He said, immediately they turn on him. Which I guess if you're a heel, that's how you know you're doing a good job, right?
Well, that's definitely what you want in the context of professional wrestling. I don't necessarily know if that's what you want in the political realm, but certainly I think some folks have earned that as well. Because frankly, and I think, of course, we all have differences of opinions. But I think what happens is all too often, especially with the left, there is this condescending attitude towards anyone who doesn't agree with them for whatever reason, be it conservative, be it constitutionalist, be it libertarian, be it whatever. Just if you don't agree with them, somehow you're not as smart as they are. Somehow you're not as moral as they are. They always occupy the moral high ground.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow you're just an inferior human being, and that certainly isn't the case. And, it's unfortunate, but as so often happens, in this case, I think art is imitating life.
I think that you're right. And this guy says, look, I voted for Hillary. He says everything that I'm saying, I believe. So it's real. He says it's fun. But I do think that he is sort of a parroting and parroting that sort of East Coast elitism when it comes to, audiences in West Virginia or Farmville, Virginia, the bumpkins out there, right? And the looking down on these people because of where they live, because of presumably who they are in the minds of these East Coast and West Coast progressives. But I'm curious, there in Knox County, Glenn, where you are, when you're talking with folks from the left, and you know, we're not talking about people who live in the Beltway or who live in San Francisco. We're talking about people who live in middle America who are progressive. Do you find that same sort of condescending attitude? Is that, do you think that's just part of what the quote unquote progressive movement has become now?
It really depends. A lot of people who are on the left are there because they somehow think the government is compassionate and is actually helping folks. And that's, to me, is just looking through things through the wrong prism and not realizing that, you know, when government gets involved, it is generally destructive as opposed to constructive. And what we see as compassion really is the use of violence to take wealth from one person and to give it to someone else. You know, there's a great essay that the guy from my neck of the woods, actually, Davy Crockett, wrote about Not Yours to Give, and how he talks about the Constitution does not allow Congress, no matter what the situation is, you know, it doesn't allow Congress to earmark funds for relief of individuals. In this case, it was people that their houses had burned down in Washington, D.C. And, you know, he caught a lot of flack on the campaign trail for doing that, despite the fact that you can look at it and say that's a really nice, compassionate thing to do. Mm-hmm. It wasn't his money to give. And that's what I think the folks that I talk with down here who come from the left are much more looking at it through that prism. It's not so much the elitism as we see on the coasts. It's much more of sort of the old style Democrat, you know, that no one is going to take care of these folks, so the government has to do it, and the government's going to do it better than anyone else does.
And how is that going over there in Knox County these days, Glenn?
Knox County, you know, the people in Knox County have a lot of common sense. I mean, we're, you know, we would be considered the reddest of the red. And the thing about it is, though, that we do take care of our own here. You know, everybody that I run into, you know, with the various projects that I'm involved with, people always want to help, and they want to help other folks who are in need, or want to help people who are down on their luck. Of course, they also want people to be responsible, in that you don't just give folks money and it essentially get them addicted to handouts. You know, mm-hmm. what you do is you help people when they're down, but you give them that handout, you know, not the hand up, not the handout. And that's what I see here is people understand that, you know, and of course, when it comes to fiscal conservatism, they understand that the government's just, frankly, going to waste money a lot. It's not going to spend the money as well as you are. When it does spend money, it causes inefficiencies in the market that cause all sorts of ripples and unintended consequences throughout the market. So, you know, I think the people here, and that's why I live here, is because the people here have an innate understanding of those issues, you know, and whether you want to call them right wing, conservative, whatever, they get it.
Well, you know, and it's funny. I mean, I'm here in Farmville, Virginia, which is population 5,000 or so. It's a very rural area. And, you know, I find that a lot of these conversations, they don't necessarily break down along that left-right divide that we see in the media. You know, right. I know plenty of folks who are concerned about, let's talk about healthcare for a second, since healthcare seems to be the issue of the day. There are a lot of folks who are really worried about health care. They're not necessarily convinced that the Republican plan is going to be great, but they know that what has happened over the past couple of years has been bad. And, you know, I think that what they're willing to listen to that argument of government getting out of the way. But I think what they really want is just for the situation to get better. Right. Which is what we all want. Now we got to have that conversation about, OK, how do we actually do that? And I think that the voters, at least around here where I live, and I think this is true across the country, the voters want that real conversation, and we're not getting it from a lot of politicians. We're getting happy talk. We're getting talking points on both sides. People are talking past one another. And in the meantime, we've got all these Americans out there saying, whoa, 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 stop it. Quit using this as a political football. We're talking about things that are vitally important to us, whether it's health care, our jobs, our right to keep and bear arms. And I think in a lot of ways, the political class doesn't know how to speak to voters anymore.
That's because they're in this bubble called Washington, D.C., where they only talk to each other. They're a big echo chamber. The nice thing about local elections and local politics is that often you're able to just the political ideology goes by the wayside, and people are willing to reach across those party lines and work with one another. And I think that's wonderful. You know, I've met so many great people, and they really do, like you said, you know, it's just they want solutions. And I think above all else is, yeah, they don't want to be treated like they're, you know, a mushroom where they're just kept in the dark and fed fertilizer, right? They want someone that's actually going to talk with them and listen to what they have to say. And I tell people, and I'm always going to do that. You know, I may not agree with you. I may have a different solution, but I'm going to listen to you, you know, because you're my neighbor and because you are essentially a shareholder in county government. So you should have a voice. And I think that is very important. Is I don't think that many people at this point feel like they're empowered. You know, they feel like their power has been completely stripped away from them, and their opinion means nothing. And that's very sad because ultimately sovereignty, as defined by our founding fathers, lies with the people. And I don't think many people feel sovereign anymore at this point.
I know. Listen, I think you're right. I think that cuts across the political divide as well. I think that explained a lot of the Bernie Sanders phenomena on the left last year. I think that explained a lot of Donald Trump's popularity. But, you know, you talk about the residents there in Knox County, and you're running for mayor of Knox County. We've got an ad for you, Glenn. I want to share this with our audience so that they can get a sense of the type of campaign that you're running there in Knox County. Take a look and a listen.
Hi. My name is Glenn Jacobs, and I'm running for mayor of Knox County here in the great state of Tennessee. In my career, I've been blessed to travel all over the world and see all the great communities that our country has to offer. But in my opinion, Knox County is the best place to live, work, and raise a family. 22 years ago, I met the love of my life here in East Tennessee. We decided to make this place our home and to raise our family here. Every day, I'm thankful that we made that decision. As your mayor, I will work with local businesses to make sure that they have everything they need to succeed. I will work with the great teachers and administrators to make sure that Knox County schools produce a competitive, world-class workforce that will attract new businesses and create jobs. I will work to make sure that government remains open and transparent so that every citizen of Knox County has a voice in the mayor's office. And I will fight to keep government small and to keep our taxes low. President Reagan once called America the shining city on a hill. Let's make Knox County an example of what that shining city looks like. Together, we can and we will make Knox County the standard bearer for the rest of Tennessee and the entire Southeast. Thank you.
So, Glenn, I gotta say, man, that's amazing.
I'd vote for him.
And look, I'm sure that there's at least there was the suggestion of Glenn, can you maybe play up the fact that, you know, you're a big star in the WWE and people know who you are, but you played this serious. I mean, this isn't a gimmicky campaign ad. Maybe those are coming. I'm always a big fan of the good sight gag and stuff like that. But as an introductory message, this was very serious. You played it straight.
Well, we are serious. That's the thing. I live here. As I said in that video, I could live anywhere essentially in the U.S. that I want, because with WWE, I traveled so much. Mm-hmm. It really didn't matter where I lived. But my family is from here, and we decided that this is where we were going to stay. There's nothing really keeping us here at this point except for the fact that we love it here. This is just a great place. I really believe that if we're going to see a change in this country, I don't think that change is that Reagan-esque idea of small, limited government. It's not going to come from Washington. It's going to come from Washington being forced to once again embrace that idea. It's going to come from the localities and the states. And my theme there is that I'd like to make Knox County the place when people look and, you know, see, okay, does liberty really work? Do free markets really work? Well, there's this place in Knox County, and there's a place in Tennessee called Knox County where they're doing really well because that's what they do. And if people around the country, you know, in all the different localities and municipalities were to sort of do that same idea, I think you would see the you would see a groundswell that would force Washington to reevaluate and say, look, if we want to stay in office, you know, we're going to start having to take conservatism seriously again and not just during the election time saying, oh, yeah, we're not going to spend a bunch of money. We're not going to waste a bunch of money. And then, of course, they get in power and, you know, that's all out the window. And people are so sick and tired. I'm sick and tired of that, you know. And that's another reason why folks – so don't trust politicians and are sick of the political game is because they say one thing, we're out on the campaign trail, and they get into office and they do something different. So as localities and as states, I think that we have to set an example. And frankly, that's the way it always has been. And then hold the federal government, hold its feet to the fire and say, look, this is what we expect.
Talking again with Glenn Jacobs, running for mayor of Knox County, Tennessee. You can follow him on Twitter at GlennJacobsTN. And Glenn, again, it's so good talking with you about this. And I'm energized after talking with you because what we need in this country are and you know, everybody's capable of doing this, right? Everybody's capable of getting involved and doing exactly what you said about caring about where you live, being involved where you live, making a difference where you live. If we all do that where we live, guess what? The entire country turns around, right?
Oh, yeah. Man, and I tell people this all the time, and a lot of folks, you know, a lot of folks think this way, but, you know, politics in Washington is, it's sexy. It's on TV all the time. That's what the talking heads talk about, you know, and that's what they make TV shows about. It's all about Washington. But the state and local government has just a big or bigger impact on your life than Washington does, you know, and it's also that's the area where you can get in and actually do something. I mean, you know, if you want to become a U.S. Congressman, more power to you, but it's going to take probably $1 million or $2 million you're going to have to raise and lots of support and lots of work. And it's very difficult, you know, whereas you get on city council or county commission or school board or some of these other positions. And most of the average person out there has a pretty good shot at that if they work hard. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's where people can really make a difference, you know, and you know, just because the media now is so big, I think what happens is we focus so much on Washington that a lot of us have lost focus on how important state and local governance is.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I look forward to doing this again. I hope we get a chance to talk again soon. And if you are in Knox County here in about a month or so, well, I guess a little bit more than a month, August 19th, we've got the NRA Bass Pro Shops night race in Bristol. Would love to see you there.
Yeah, hey, I'll make it up to that, man.
Awesome. All right, we'll keep talking. Cool. Glenn, as always, sir, really appreciate your time and look forward to getting a chance to do this again soon.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate it.
You bet. Glenn Jacobs joining us again on Twitter, at GlennJacobsTN. Hope I didn't sound like too much of a fanboy there. I was trying to keep my professional veneer going.
I mean, who can?
Yeah, why
bother, Cam?
There's no shame in that. It was awesome. He's a great guy. Man, oh, man.
He's smart. He knows his stuff.
Dude, to see him in the ring and perform and then hear him, he's like, yeah. Wow, man, that's so cool.
He's a good dude.
I love that.
Hey,
before
we go to break, and by the way, so that was we played that and we played Cheryl Atkinson. We'll have more interviews in the first half of 2017, next couple of days. So Kerry Pickett, our friend over at the Daily Caller, has a very interesting article. We were talking about what happened in New York with the tragic murder of the NYPD officer. Of course, we remember what happened last week at the Bronx Hospital, Dr. Henry Bello, when he went in and shot up the hospital, killing a doctor who, from what I recall, she was just covering someone's shift as a favor, and she was just there. Just horrible story.
Jeez.
But so Kerry writes in the Daily Caller, and we'll put this article at Cam and Company on Twitter. The Bronx hospital killer was able to purchase a firearm because the New York legal system granted him a plea bargain on a 2004 felony charge. And this is normally around the time Cam would do his deal of the day. So this definitely is the deal of the day. 2 weeks ago, Dr. Henry Bello passed a criminal background check and bought an AR-15 type rifle in upstate New York. The rifle was modified to comply with the state's strict firearms law. Bello traveled to Bronx Lebanon Hospital Center last Friday, used that gun to shoot his colleagues, killing one woman, Dr. Tracy Sinyi, Yi Tam and injuring six others. He then killed himself. The New York Post reported that Bella was arrested in 2004 for grabbing a 24-year-old woman by the crotch and attempting to carry her away. "You're coming with me," he reportedly told the victim. Initially charged with felony sex abuse, a conviction that would have appeared on his background report, Bello plea bargained his case down to a misdemeanor. Then Manhattan Judge Melissa Jackson also granted a special waiver to Bello 2 years after the assault so he could apply for specific jobs and licenses within the healthcare field. Just 12 days after receiving the waiver from the judge, he was hired as a pharmacy tech in the city's hospital system. This judge who gave him the waiver is now an acting New York State Supreme Court justice. So we talked earlier about the man who killed the New York City police officer today, Officer Familia. You know, career criminal, revolving door of justice. Now you see this this person. He was granted the plea bargain because the legal system on this felony charge there too. At some point, we need to get serious about the people who commit the crimes and keeping them in jail and having them stay there because there's a reason they're in jail.
Right. And that was one of the biggest things that poor Jeff Sessions was suffering through because people felt that he was just so tough on crime. He was too extreme. He wasn't empathetic.
And why is that bad?
Right.
That's
exactly
what I don't understand. We talk about it, and the way you say it even, Jesse, is that it's your subconscious. That's what people say. You're too tough on crime. We need to get lighter on crime. We need to lower sentences. We need to keep it up.
Yeah, right. It's not fair to these people. They never get to have a life. Exactly. Because they took away a life. And there have been cases of people who were released by President Obama in his little amnesty thing he did for these criminals who had drug charges because they keep calling this victimless. One of them was coming out of the courthouse and got shot as soon as he walked out.
Well, and remember, some of these, you know, he was talking about the idea that low-level offenders should, you know, serve shorter sentences. Okay, fine, you can argue that back and forth. But remember, the Obama administration allowed these low-level, quote-unquote, drug offendees with gun charges on them as well.
On top of it.
And if you're going to talk, you know, especially the Obama administration, you're talking about gun control and keeping people behind bars. Why are you letting these people out of jail?
And you can't tell me it's victimless. Okay, when you're a drug dealer, you now are causing addiction in this country that is causing crime, that is causing families to be broken apart, causing children to be born addicts. There are victims. That's why these drugs are illegal, because of the chaos and mayhem that they cause. All you have to do, if anybody hasn't seen American Gangster, it's in a fabulous movie, because he brought all of the drugs over from Vietnam when the military was having their transport planes. Next thing you know, people are becoming basically crackheads of that era, whatever, what was it, heroin, I believe it was. And, you know, you can't say there's no victim. The addict, the child, the family destroyed by drugs.
Yeah.
Wreaks havoc in a community.
The child born who's already addicted.
Addicted. Don't tell me it's victimless.
Yeah.
It is not victimless. And many of the people that I've known who are very good, strong supporters of marijuana laws, I know people, they'll say that it's not addictive. I know people who have to be high every single day. And when they're not high, they're temperamental. They are very moody and up and down. So there are things with drugs that we have to address before you start saying it's victimless. There are victims.
Absolutely. All right, we'll take a break. Coming up next, Miles Hall, Hall & Hall Consulting, Pew Research. Big study just came out on gun ownership. He's going to kind of break it down with us a little bit. We'll be back with more of Cam & Company, fueled by Hornady, right after this. Speaking with Colton Cassell with NRA Store. Colton, I love talking to you guys at the NRA Store. You have got it going on. You have seemed to be mind readers with us NRA folks to read our minds, what we like, what we need, good, interesting stuff, good quality. So let's get started first, though, Colton. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. What is NRA Store? What is it all about?
NRA Store is a retail storefront for NRA members to shop and buy NRA merchandise while supporting vital NRA programs.
And let's expand on that a little bit. Where does the money from NRA Store go?
100% of the profits go directly to support vital NRA programs. So when you're shopping with us, you're supporting ILA and all other important initiatives that the NRA are standing behind.
Which, Colton, I think is so cool because we like to donate to the NRA because we believe in the NRA and supporting the Second Amendment. But at the same time, you buy something, you get this really good practical stuff, and guess what? You're helping to support the NRA. So that's awesome. A lot of great items that we can get into, but let's also talk about other stuff you guys do. You have giveaways at NRAstore.com. You have clearance department. Virtual online catalogs. I know I've gotten regular catalogs from you guys. You got a lot of stuff going on there on that website, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, we have a NRA Store customer club, so you can actually go right onto our main page, our main NRA Store page, and join the customer club just by simply entering an email. That signs you up for monthly promotions where we do shipping discounts, special sales.
Man, I need to get on that.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. It's the place to be.
We're almost out of time. Colton Cassell with NRA Store. All that information, sir, is at NRAstore.com, correct?
Yes, sir.
NRAstore.com. Colton Cassell with NRA Store. Thank you for what you do, and thanks for being on the program.
I emigrated from Venezuela, one of the most dangerous countries in the world today. A few years ago, the government came for our guns. We were told we would be safer without them. Of course, the politicians, the rich and famous, their bodyguards and criminals, they still have their guns. Everyone else lives in fear. Mothers and fathers are powerless to defend their families. But the drug cartels and gangs, the colectivos, still have all the guns they want, and 90% of murders are never solved. The biggest mistake Venezuelans made was believing that this could never happen. Today, they would do anything for the Second Amendment freedom that we enjoy as Americans. Never, ever take it for granted. I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I am freedom's safest place.
This land. This is life's stadium. And the people who enter must know it is not a place for media hype or cheering fans. The spotlights of sun and moon and stars will never showcase human arrogance. In fact, the only contest that is celebrated here is the Earth's determination to sustain life. Join this celebration. Arrive with a purpose. Compete on the world's most challenging fields. Winning and losing won't mean as much as just being. You will be among the most courageous and competitive athletes on the planet and in awe of its rules. Trust the hunter in your blood.
And we're back here on Cam and Company. If you only could hear...
I'm calling HR.
...people who are listening and watching...
Can I file an HR complaint against Jesse Jane, even though she doesn't work here?
The banter that goes on between the breaks. It's a whole other show within a show, Cam.
It is
right?
A show. We got it, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow. Anyway, we're back...
Watch that on jessejaneduff.com.
Oh, that sounds like an exciting site.
It's going to be a.k.a. SmackDown.
That's right.
In more ways than one.
Yes.
Joining us now, Miles Hall, our good friend from Hall & Hall Consulting. Miles, welcome back to the show. How are you, sir?
I am well today. How are you guys doing there?
Pretty
we're,
well.
We're good.
Yes. So Pew came out with a big report, and you sent me over a copy of it, and then luckily Cameron helped me because I looked at it prepping for the show. It's like 74
yeah.
pages.
John's not very good with reading comprehension, Miles, you need to get in bullet points.
Yes.
So to speak. Pardon the pun.
Little dialogue balloons over my head. Yeah, so we wanted to grab you to kind of break it down for us. Tell us in this report what's it all about.
Well, first of all, it's the Pew report, as so many of these reports when they come out, are awfully biased at times. This one, whether it's biased or not, is actually aligning itself with some of the numbers anyway that we've heard about around the industry. For example, that the average gun age, a buyer anyway, is continuing to drop. At one point, it was in the upper 50s. Then it went into the lower 40s, and then it went into the upper 30s. We're now shifting again to the lower 30s. In fact, they're showing 43% of the folks who are now at least working on getting guns is in that 18 to 29 age bracket.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big step in this as you begin to look through this. Also, that the men and women that own guns are still following that very close number of each other. You know, we were 53-47 male-female ratio at the store back when we were running H&H, and that was kind of syncing up with other dealers around the country. This one is showing that it's in the 40-ish each range now a little bit in their numbers, which is at least something as far as the ownership. Now, what we're talking about is percentage of ownership. In other words, of the people within that age line, 40% or 44% of them are men and 40 are female. Of that are in that particular age line, then it breaks out into the other ages is the way that it works out.
Miles,
but it is an interesting report, isn't it?
Yeah, I got to ask you this, bring up this one number that I find striking. This is for reading from the Pew's website, Pew Research's website. And NRA members are also significantly more likely than other gun owners to say they have a gun that is loaded and easily accessible to them at all times, 53 to 34%. And among handgun owners, NRA members are twice as likely to say they carry a gun with them outside of their home all or most of the time, 44 versus 22%. Here's the right now, if I could add bold and italics as I speak this is the unbelievable number. They are also more likely to say they have taken a gun safety course at some point. 84% of NRA members have done this, compared with 67% of gun owners who don't belong to the NRA. Miles, John, Jesse, what do gun control organizations call themselves now?
Gun safety
organizations.
Yeah, safety
organizations. Yes, they do. I'm sorry, I had to laugh.
So it would seem that the NRA, as biased as we are, I understand, but they are the true gun safety organization because 84% of members have taken a gun safety course.
Right.
Does the other side teach courses, Miles? Where can I find that there in Oklahoma?
You're not going to find that here.
Oh, damn it.
Well, I don't think they have anybody who doesn't want a gun in Oklahoma, so there's no need. That is the reddest state and probably one of the most pro-gun states in the union. Yes. So.
But I find that number, that's a number that should be 84%. Shouted from the rooftops.
Right.
The real gun safety organization.
Yeah, the real gun safety organization. I mean, that's one of the – I'm looking at, you know, all these numbers on these surveys, the 60 pages of numbers, it gets a little blurry. This is the highest number I see on there, 84%. That's a damn good number, Miles.
Yeah. In fact, the overall, to look at it this way, those who are not NRA members, the number was still high because that says a lot about the culture of the people that are buying today.
Yep.
And that is they want to learn, they want to do right. And in every facility that all these new shooting sports centers that are popping up all over – they're all very busy working with people because they walk in and say, I want to learn, then I want to buy, you know, or I had this given to me before I use it, I want to learn. That's the mentality, which is the way it should be, quite honestly.
Absolutely. So, Miles, what else jumps out at you about this report?
Well, I thought the pro-NRA aspect of it was phenomenal. I'm glad you guys picked up on that. It is 70-something pages long, but it was pretty awesome and pretty cool to read through. It's showing that the numbers are still very strong in the states, in the United States. In fact, we're still waiting for June numbers to come out from NICS. But to give you an idea, in May, because they're all saying, oh, the industry has slowed down because of Trump and all of this, 32 states in May were up compared to the previous year's same month. Five additional states were flush or even with the previous year. Now, we track all the big states, but there's several small states that we don't follow. But when you're looking at overall percentages, the industry is still doing very well, very, very well.
All right. Miles, thank you so much. Hall & Hall Consulting. Miles Hall, our good friend out there in Oklahoma. Thanks for what you do every day. Thanks for being on the program, and we love to have your industry inside info on the gun industry and your knowledge on that stuff. Thank you, sir.
You bet. You guys take care, okay? Good luck.
Thank you.
That guy is a font.
He knows his stuff.
And he made the right move. He moved from just had one of the most preeminent gun ranges and training facilities out there, and then he moved, he and his wife, to doing Hall & Hall Consulting. And now he's like the guru on where the trends are in the industry and everything. So we love having him on the show. All right, shall we wrap it with Stephen Cruiser?
Sounds good.
All right, we're going to take a break. Stephen Cruiser with IJ Review joins us here in just a few minutes. Stay around. We'll talk a little news and issues of the day. There's nothing to talk about today, Cameron.
No,
so
not
what
at
can
all.
We possibly talk to
nothing,
Stephen about?
Nothing.
All right, we'll be back.
Just don't say CNN.
CNN. We'll be back with more Cameron Company Fueled by Hornady right after this.
Outside Washington, D.C. at the Congressional Shootout, here is Chris Cox, head of the NRA's Institute for Legislative Action. Good to see you, Chris.
It's great to be out here.
What do you feel like here in Maryland? I know we're here at a trap and ski club, but we're in the state of Maryland. You know, for people who don't know around the country, people think of California, they think of New York. Maryland is pretty up there, too.
It is. It's one of the most challenging states, and it's one of the most frustrating states. We've talked about the Fourth Circuit and the total debacle of the court case there. But this is part of what we have to deal with, and part of what we do. We can sit back and be frustrated and complain about it, or we can move forward with an agenda to try to rectify and try to fix these problems. We were just talking to our friend Congressman Richard Hudson, who's carrying the House a right to carry reciprocity bill. So there's a lot of things that can be done outside of the state of Maryland and how they approach the Second Amendment. But ultimately, this is part of what we do every day.
You know, you talked there's here lots of members of Congress, but we also talk about President Trump's in the White House, Ryan Zinke's Interior Secretary, a lot of good people in with this issue when it comes to hunting, shooting, fishing. But there's also people who will be complacent. Oh, it's the salad days. You know, how do you keep the message that listen, you've got to still keep fighting?
Well, the work didn't stop on November 8th. It was a great election, no question about it. But something else happened on November 8th, or on November 9th, our opponents woke up and they were less than pleased. With President Trump, violently so in some cities. And you've seen a commitment and an energy on their side. You're seeing it in this Georgia 6 special election. I was just out in Montana this past week with Donald Trump Jr. Campaigning for Gianforte, and you're seeing an energy and a fundraising and an operation on the other side that we can't sit back and be apathetic over. All of these, we have to bring the same moral purpose and same intensity to all of these legislative fights that we brought to the elections last year. If we do that and we stay engaged, then we prove that we can shock the world and change the course of history. But if we sit back and don't engage further, then this is going to be a short-term window for us.
You talk about violence. I saw a story yesterday in North Dakota. These town halls, these members of Congress that go back, and these town halls are really nasty. And there was one yesterday in North Dakota. Some guy grabbed the congressman's collar, put dollars in it. You know, they're trying to pay him off. You've been in this. You know the game. You've been in this town a long time. You know how this all works. But have you seen... has it gotten so bad that we're past the point of no return when it comes to political civility?
Well, you hope not. But you saw President Obama had an opportunity to pull this country together on so many different levels, and all he did was further divide the country. You've seen a mainstream media that's not interested in reporting, you know, a civil dialogue, civil disagreements. They're interested in trying to undermine this president, certainly trying to undermine the National Rifle Association. So there's nothing really new about politics, sometimes being personal and ugly, but the level... has never been this high. And so the hope is that, you know, we can have an intellectually honest debate of ideas. But the problem is, when we have an intellectually honest debate of ideas, we always win. Honestly, I mean, and so when you don't have the facts on your side, you go with emotion. And when the only emotion that works is one of violence and outrage, then, you know, and the media will report on it day by day, then that's what they go with. And it's unfortunate, but it's part of the world that we have to live in and deal with.
This event is run by the Congressional Sportsman Foundation. You know, they talk a lot about hunting and fishing and angling. Talk about the NRA's role when it comes to hunting. Some people think the NRA just thinks only about the guns, Second Amendment. Talk about the hunting aspect.
Sure. I mean, the National Rifle Association, whether it's in courtrooms, state legislatures, in the international arena, and certainly in Washington, D.C., we're the tip of the spear on all of these issues, whether it's our hunting heritage or our Second Amendment freedom. So this is a great group. Congressional Sportsman's Caucus was started in 1988, 1989. It's the largest caucus in Congress, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily the most successful caucus in Congress. We've had a frustrating run for the last 7 or 8 years with the lack of the ability to pass a meaningful sportsman's package of, you know, dealing with land access issues, dealing with closures, dealing with range development, dealing with, you know, carrying on Army Corps lands, dealing with the Hearing Protection Act, a lot of things that are really no-brainers when it comes to providing, you know, better public policies that relates to sportsmen and hunters out there. And that's what we're up there doing. And, you know, we'll take all the help we can get, certainly. But it's ultimately up to the people, you know, NRA members and sportsmen and hunters across the country to make sure that our priorities become Congress's priorities. They're not just going to happen. As we've talked before, it's not like the day after the election, Congress said, hey, let's go expand self-defense. Let's go deal with sportsmen's access issues. No, it's up to us to do that work. And as you mentioned, apathy can be a problem, but the energy and the commitment that gun owners and NRA members brought to the elections last year, if we carry that out and maintain that level of enthusiasm, I think we have a window to really get some great things done.
And we're back here on Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. John Pop, Cameron Gray, Jesse Jane Duff. Jesse Dane will be back tomorrow. We're
the company.
So excited.
The company.
The company.
I'm always excited when I'm here.
We love
just
having
keep that
you.
In mind.
Love
so.
Having you. Yeah. Jesse Jane, give it up.
That's fantastic.
Yay.
Let's also keep those hands going. Yes. Give it up for Stephen Cruiser of IJ Reviews.
Part of his contract, he needs applause
yes.
before he comes on any show.
Stephen.
That makes me happy.
Standing yeah. ovation. We're standing also.
Thank you.
Stephen, how is it that every time you come on the show, there's a story that breaks just before you come on that's so perfect for you? It's unbelievable.
I know, and it's unreal. And usually it's on a day that I'm like watching baseball and not paying attention to the news.
You'll enjoy the story. You'll enjoy the story, as I know everyone else will. This is from Daily Caller. South Park creator says, the show will lay off Trump jokes to avoid, quote, becoming CNN.
Oh, no.
South Park creator Trey Parker says his subversive show won't feature too many Trump-themed gags in its upcoming season, a deliberate effort to avoid becoming a cable news show disguised as an animated comedy. Stephen Cruiser, take it away.
That pretty much describes most of these news parody shows right now.
Right.
That's all they've become lately. And
yes.
There are people out there who still, and they're successful people, who realize that half of the country isn't the way Hollywood thinks it is, and they still have an audience out there. Kevin Hart, the comedian, he deliberately decided not to do any Trump humor, any Trump jokes, because he said it alienates half of my audience.
Yep. Well, you know, and you talk about the late night shows.
And he's having a great year.
You talk about the late night shows. I don't know if you guys caught this. The Washington Post last week, they assembled a group of, like a children's choir, and they assembled and they made a video of these kids singing Trump's tweets. It's like everyone is trying to out Colbert each other. Hmm. Even the Washington Post is like doing goofy. That's something you'd see on Colbert or the Trevor Noah show. But you know, the Washington Post is getting into the goofy, hey, let's knock down Trump in a fun new way business. It's kind of strange.
Well, last night I was at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery watching a movie because Los Angeles, and
right.
It was the great 4th of July thing. It was wonderful. And there was a group right next to us. And usually it's a huge audience. There are like 4,000 people out on the lawn watching the movie projected on the mausoleum. And there was this group behind me that were watching Jurassic Park, and they kept trying to make bad Trump joke tie-ins, and they're yelling them out.
Oh, geez.
And finally, everybody in the play started telling them to shut up.
Wow, really? Even in LA?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, in Hollywood.
In Hollywood.
Wow.
We were in Hollywood. And everybody was just like, shut up. You're not funny. None of this is working.
You know, speaking of Hollywood, one of the stories that I've seen crop up the last couple of days, there was a girl who tweeted a picture of herself cleaning up Trump's star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Yes.
It became this viral picture.
Well.
And then all of a sudden, this became the all these people on the left had to go over and just face the star. They put stickers on it. They spit on it. Middle fingers up. And this girl is getting all this back. I saw a quick clip with her. I think it was on Fox and Friends. She's getting death threats. The girl who originally did the cleanup job. She's getting death threats and hate messages because she tried to clean up a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Oh.
And I looked at some of these tweets. There was one tweet. It had like hundreds of thousands of retweets of this vulgar messages on the Trump star. And the hatred is so bad. But it's interesting to hear even in Hollywood, people have had enough of it.
Well, and the left will tell you that this is just because it's Trump. They've been like this for a long time. Mm. They've got nothing but this anger. I mean, that's what Occupy Wall Street was. It was a long extended tantrum. There was no end game there. They weren't really protesting anything. They just wanted to be mad. And that's all they've got lately. When I was younger, the left stood for something and they had things that they could debate with you about. Now they just want to be angry. There's no end game to any of these protests. They just want to keep protesting.
Well, it looks to me, this is Jesse Jane Duff, it just seems like it looks to me that it's just flipped from being the cheerleading squad to now being the angry squad, because they weren't reporting the news much better before. They weren't being honest in a lot of the journalism. They weren't presenting the facts that of the dishonesty that Hillary Clinton herself was. CNN was giving the debate questions to Donna Brazile. I mean, the list goes on and on with the incredulous activities that they were doing trying to support and prop up the Trump administration. And if it weren't for a lot of the media's, the grassroots types that were really pulling some of these stories along, I think Americans would have been largely misinformed. I think many Americans who have been hardcore watching CNN know nothing about Benghazi, know nothing about Susan Rice's lies about the video, know nothing about anything. So what it boils down to is it's, like you said, it's been like this for a long time because it's just been protecting their golden calf.
Yeah, I mean, when Barack Obama was in office, the press was basically behaving like a bunch of teenage girls at a One Direction concert.
And that's how I still behave. Yeah, just keep that in mind.
They did that for 8 years. And now that they're trying to attempt to do their jobs again, they're really overcorrecting and overreaching. Mm-hmm. But they're just partisan advocates, right? This is something that I was talking to a friend of mine earlier today. It goes back to the old Andrew Breitbart thing. Destroy the Democrat media complex. That needs to happen. I want there to be a good, functional, free press in this country. I don't want there to be a propaganda wing for one party, which is what we've got right now.
We got just about a minute left, Stephen, and I'm very proud of the three of us here on the show that we have not been suckered by the CNN blackmail story and not talked about it, which has been discussed by ad nauseum by every show and network, I'm sure, right by now. But let's give it a minute, Stephen. When you look at the story and you look at the depths to which Andrew Kaczynski and K-File and CNN went to uncover this guy who sent a dumb wrestling video meme that he also posted bad things. We gotta track him down. And it was all in an effort to try to describe Trump. That's all it was, because people are tweeting racist, stupid crap every day, and CNN isn't trying to uncover them. CNN meme or not. When you see the madness that's been going on the last couple of days, what do you think?
The only thing anybody needs to remember about CNN, and it seems to be getting lost already, is that we're only a week removed from them firing four people for publishing a story that lied about Trump and the Russia connection.
Right, yep.
So CNN's moral high ground is non-existent. We're a week away from that is all right now. So where they think that they're morally superior to anyone, I don't know. So this is they're thoroughly awful through and through.
Wow, very good.
Fair enough. All right, Steve, how do people keep up with you and your travels and your touring and just follow what you're up to?
Yeah, I'm going on the road in 3 weeks. I'm going to Indianapolis. Back on the road again.
Nice.
Finally unleashed on America. I'll be at Crackers in Indianapolis. And you just on Twitter right now, just everything will be on Twitter. I'm still working on my new site. It's not up yet.
Is it really? The comedy club's called Crackers?
Crackers, like, I love
That's
it.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Hey,
That's,
welcome to Crackers.
Will you be at Zany's the week after?
How about the Laugh
Zany's? Zany's in Chicago is my favorite club in America, actually.
Nice. All right, well, tell us when you're going to be at the Chuckle Hut.
Yeah, okay.
That sounds like a strip club.
It does, actually. They do both.
They do both.
My.
Steven,
well, that's
Steven awesome. Opens up for the stripper there.
For everyone in Indianapolis.
He opens for the stripper? That's great.
For
opens
everyone
what?
In Indy, I'm sure they'll be excited about it. That's cool. It's good to hear, Steven.
Yeah, it'll be fun. I haven't been in a club in a while.
Awesome.
Well, we're a comedy routine here, too, so join us anytime.
Thank you, Steven.
Thank you, Steven.
Take care.
All right. Crackers.
And I'm sure in Indianapolis he will be hanging out with our friend Tony Katz.
I was going to say. That screams out right there with that one.
That will be full of danger.
Craziness.
Thank you, JJD.
Thank you. I appreciate
JJD.
That I was here.
Jesse, and we'll see you back tomorrow.
Yes. Absolutely.
And I'll have better snacks tomorrow for you.
Yes. Feed me.
We will feed you.
Feed me.
Jesse Jane Duff, Cameron Gray.
I'll go anywhere for a meal.
Thanks for being here, both of you. We'll see you again tomorrow for more Cam and Company Fueled by Hornady. Have a great time, and we'll see you again soon.